BBC Scam Safe Week.
Across this week on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And in tomorrow evening's It's a Fair Cop, Alfie Moore guides us through the modern world of scams. That's tomorrow at 6:30. On FM, on digital and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday the 25th of November. This is Today with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, the headlines today. The Ukrainian capital Kyiv has come under heavy Russian attack as diplomatic efforts to end the war continue, with the UK chairing a virtual meeting of Ukraine's allies. Later in the programme, we speak to the EU's foreign policy chief Kaya Kallas, who gives her reaction to the draft framework.
You just can't have a situation where, you know, you invade another country, you walk away with more than you have before, and there's no accountability, there's nothing. So, you know, this kind of activity just invites more aggression.
And the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has urged Labour MPs to unite behind her budget while warning them that they might not like every measure in it.
Also in today's programme, we tell the remarkable story of Polly, the golden retriever who saved its owner's life by barking when he had a heart attack. We have exclusive access to a woman's prison, hearing from inmates about life on the inside.
You leave prison with more issues than you had coming in. The trauma of actually being in this environment and the things that you see and the things that you hear, I think that is another reason why the reoffending rate is so high.
And what a viral TikTok dance reveals about the changing way we consume sport. All that after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, has again come under heavy Russian missile and drone attack. Two blocks of flats were hit and at least two people have been killed. Power and water supplies have been cut in some areas of the city. Russia says that it has also been targeted. James Reid reports.
Ukraine's Air Force said the Russian attack involved swarms of drones, as well as cruise and ballistic missiles, launched from the land, sea and air. Large explosions were reported in Kyiv, as air defence systems tried to protect the capital. Ukraine has also been striking Russia, with attacks reported in the border regions of Krasnodar and Rostov. The upsurge in violence follows days of intense diplomacy aimed at ending the war. Russia appears determined to maintain the military pressure as both sides seek to influence US-led efforts to achieve a peace deal.
Keir Starmer is to host a virtual meeting of the grouping of Ukraine's international allies known as the Coalition of the Willing. In an interview with this programme, the European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, said any final peace agreement could not just be made up of Russian demands.
You know, if we want to end this for good, we really, really need to have concessions on Russian side. Because if you look at those points, I mean, the points shouldn't be, how to make it easier for Russia to invade again, to downsize Ukrainian army and all these points, but actually how to make it impossible for Russia to invade again.
And you can hear the full interview with Kaya Kallas at 8:10 this morning. Rachel Reeves has delivered a defiant message to Labour MPs ahead of her budget tomorrow, telling them that she will be Chancellor for years to come and that they must stick together if they want to win the next election. She promised she would announce a Labour budget that was progressive, but she also warned of tough choices. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Politics is a team sport, Rachel Reeves told restive Labour MPs last night. The need for that reminder is a sign of just how fraught some of the build-up to this budget has been. With growing questions about Labour's leadership, the Chancellor told the party it must stick together in order to win the next election and promised she would still be in the job next year and the year after. But Ms Reeves warned of difficult choices in tomorrow's budget and told MPs they might not like every measure she announces. It's a package, not a pick and mix, she said. There were hints of more money for the NHS and measures to curb inflation. Rachel was strong and honest, one convinced MP said afterwards. Others were not so sure and said her pleas for unity sounded desperate.
Nigel Farage has said that he has never directly racially abused anybody in response to allegations in The Guardian newspaper that he was racist and anti-Semitic towards pupils while at school. The Reform UK leader said the alleged incidents took place almost 50 years ago and that there was a strong political element to the claims. He was asked about the accusations by a reporter.
I never directly racially abused anybody, no.
Again, define directly for me. What do you mean by directly?
By taking it out on an individual on the basis of who they are or what they are, no.
Again, taking it out on somebody is different to saying
have
stuff
to somebody.
Have
I ever misspoken in my life, in my younger days, when I was a child? Probably.
Reform UK said that the allegations were entirely without foundation. Labour says he should come clean on claims over his past. Tech firms are being urged to adopt new guidelines aimed at protecting women and girls in the UK from abuse online. The regulator, Ofcom, says the measures go above and beyond what's needed to comply with the law. It says no woman should have to think twice before expressing themselves online, nor face relentless trolling for simply doing their jobs. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Ofcom's new guidelines are not a legal requirement, but the regulator says it'll publicly name the tech companies which choose to adopt them. They're practical and include recommendations such as enabling the multiple blocking of abusive comments in one go rather than having to go through them all individually, demonetising content that contains sexual violence, and nudging social media users whose posts are flagged as abusive or misogynistic before they're published. But the watchdog has already faced criticism that it lacks teeth. So far, it's issued just 2 fines for non-compliance with the Online Safety Act. One of them was given to the platform 4chan, which has refused to pay it.
Police forces across the UK are to prioritise trying to catch organised crime gangs that are targeting farms. The National Police Chiefs Council says issues such as machinery theft strike at the heart of rural life. Stolen items valued at nearly £13 million have been recovered so far this year. Here's our Rural Affairs producer, Malcolm Pryor.
The nature of crime in the countryside has changed. No longer just opportunistic, break-ins and thefts of farm equipment are now often meticulously organised and planned by gangs using high-tech equipment, and many are part of wider international criminal networks. That means farm equipment and vehicles from the UK are being smuggled abroad, mainly to Eastern Europe. Now the National Police Chiefs Council has made cracking down on organised crime one of its top priorities in the new UK-wide rural crime strategy. And that's been welcomed by the National Farmers Union, which has also called for more visible policing.
Councillors in County Antrim have voted to change the name of a street in Carrickfergus, which has been called Prince Andrew Way since 1986. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was stripped of all his titles earlier this month because of his links to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Council officers say that they will investigate their options for renaming the street and present a report at a later date.
Charles, thank you very much indeed. 7 minutes past six now. Let's see what the weather has in store for us today with Helen Willetts. Morning, Helen.
Morning, Anna. Hello. Both you and I know it's been a colder start to the morning this morning. We've got some sunshine, though, as a result when the sun rises. So for England and Wales, plenty of that sunshine around. A little bit of mist and fog this morning, a touch of frost. And for eastern England, so southeast England, East Anglia, and the northeast of England, we've still got a keen north breeze holding our temperature down today, bringing a bit more cloud and some showers. They could be a little bit wintry over the North York Moors. But I think as the day goes on, they'll become fewer and further between, so more sunshine allowed here this afternoon, along with the rest of England and Wales, away from Cornwall, Pembrokeshire and the Clun Peninsula, where we've got what's known as the Pembrokeshire Dangler, blinging lots of showers here through the day. So they're the exceptions rather than the rule to the dry and fine weather. Temperatures, though, down on yesterday, only 6 to 9 degrees and just 4 in northeast England. To Northern Ireland now. We've got plenty of dry and bright weather to start this morning. There's a touch of frost, so one or two icy patches potentially. Temperatures, though, in the sunshine lifting to, 7 to 10 degrees Celsius today, with just isolated showers mostly in northern coastal counties. A similar story for Scotland. Really cold this morning, minus 5 in some of the northwest Highland glens, so there will be some icy patches around where we've had rain, sleet and snow showers more recently. Temperatures only lifting to between 4 and 7 degrees today, despite the sunshine. And there will be a scattering of showers, mostly in coastal counties in the north and the east, fewer than yesterday, but still a little wintry on the hills. And just one or two showers for the Hebrides too.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. It is now 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Chancellor's pre-budget briefing for Labour MPs makes the front page of the Times. Rachel Reeves hit out at armchair critics who questioned her ability to do the job, it reports. She also said leaks in the run-up to the budget had been incredibly destabilising. The latest of which, according to the Mail, is that she's planning to cut the annual £20,000 cash ISA allowance to £12,000. Ms Reeves is expected to argue that billions of pounds sitting in savings accounts would generate better returns if they were invested in the stock market.
The Financial Times this morning reports that banks have been asked to make prominent public endorsements of the budget. Treasury officials want lenders to praise policies and, at the very least, refrain from criticising government decisions.
The Telegraph claims the BBC is in disarray over claims of bias as it leads on yesterday's hearing of the Commons Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee. The paper says the leadership of the corporation's chairman, Samir Shah, came under intense scrutiny. The Sun's message to the BBC is emphatic: reform or die.
The Times and the FT report that ministers have backed Heathrow's £49 billion plan to build a third runway. One of the biggest aspects of the proposal will reportedly involve rerouting the M25 so it passes through a tunnel underneath that runway.
The Daily Mirror says Nigel Farage is facing mounting pressure to investigate pro-Putin links within Reform UK. The party's former leader in Wales, Nathan Gill, was jailed last week for taking pro-Russian bribes. Any more Vlad apples, Nigel, is the Mirror's main headline.
And reggae's great pioneer is how the Eye describes Jimmy Cliff after his death at the age of 81. According to the Times, only Bob Marley took precedence over Jimmy Cliff as the most successful singing star to emerge from Jamaica. The Guardian says his music lifted people through hard times, with the paper's obituary praising the stirring optimism of his 1969 hit, Wonderful World, Beautiful People.
Tempting to hum it, but I'll resist the temptation. It's 11 minutes past six.
Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky are likely to discuss the revised US ceasefire plan for Ukraine face-to-face as a next step at some point after the revisions to make it less weighted towards Russia's demands. David Willis, our North America correspondent, tell me what the current thinking at the White House is on that deal.
Well, President Trump has gone from berating officials in Kyiv for supposedly showing him ingratitude to teasing the possibility that, in his words, something good might be coming on this front on his Truth Social media platform. Mr. Trump wrote today, "Is it really possible that big progress is being made in peace talks between Russia and Ukraine? Don't believe it until you see it. But something good just may be happening." Well, later on, the White House Press Secretary, Karoline Leavitt, told reporters that there had been some of what she described as very productive conversations. She said the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and the special envoy, Steve Witkoff, had gone through the peace plan with the Ukrainians in Geneva, fine-tuned those points, those 28 points, and there were now just a couple of points of disagreement, she said, that the teams were working through.
We're expecting more talks today, David, between European leaders, the coalition of the willing. I wonder, are they in a position that they can really exert influence on Donald Trump's thinking? Or is Ukraine, or is Russia? You know, does anybody have the ability to change his mind on this?
I mean, this American plan sent shockwaves through many European capitals. It caused a fair bit of dismay, I might add, among some Republican senators, those who believe that the 28-point plan was too generous to Russia. We do know that Ukraine and Europe's sticking points include such things as ceding territory to Russia that Moscow hasn't conquered, such as the Donbass, proposals to limit the future size of Ukraine's armed forces, and the proposed ban on Ukraine's future membership of NATO, all points that both the Ukrainians and the Europeans would find very difficult to swallow.
David Willis, thank you, in the US. And we'll get the view from Kyiv in about 20 minutes' time.
It is now 6:13. Too many women who are victims of domestic abuse end up in prison. So says the prison ministers, who says that new laws to change this are likely in the next year. He's been speaking to our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha, who's just come back from a visit to a female prison in Surrey. Morning to you, Seema. These changes to the law were recommended, weren't they, in a recent report?
Yes, morning, Nick. Yes, that's a sentencing bill, which, as you say, is going through Parliament, and it's partly about reducing short prison sentences and focusing more on community-based punishments to reduce overcrowding in our prisons. Maybe our listeners remember that last year we were very close to reaching full capacity across the male estate. But women make up just 4% of the women of the prison population. There are only around 3,500 women in prison in England. And this bill, which is expected to be made law, will mean fewer women in prison. The prisons minister, Lord Timpson, told me that women who are victims of domestic abuse shouldn't be in prison, but in a safe place away from violence. He says serious offenders should be locked up, but he's talking about women who in some cases have committed less serious crimes that could have been influenced by domestic violence. So, for example, women who may have been coerced into theft or drug dealing by their partners. 60% of women, Nick, in prison say that they're victims of domestic violence. And the charity Women in Prison indicate that 56% of women serving a prison sentence will re-offend within a year or so. But the other side of the coin is that these women are criminals. They've broken the law, and there will be little sympathy among some for their circumstances. In fact, when I was inside HMP Send a few days ago in Surrey, a women's prison, some inmates there told me that their experience of prison had made them not want to offend again. And lastly, the Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, says it will often be more appropriate to hand down alternative punishments to pregnant women and victims of domestic abuse.
Seema Khatecha, thank you very much indeed. We're going to hear your report from inside that prison after 8:30.
It's 16 minutes past six now. The cash ISA is in the spotlight once again, with the limit that you can put into one each year reportedly going to drop in tomorrow's budget. Sean Farrington's got more on that. The rest of the morning's business news as well. Sean, morning. This is always something that pricks up people's ears.
Yes, and we've had plenty of conversations over recent months about whether this will be something that's looked at or not. These individual savings account ISAs, of course, they're tax-efficient savings products that mean that those who have them don't pay tax on interest gains or returns made. It's been widely reported now, the Financial Times and Bloomberg kicking it off, that the amount UK savers can put into cash ISAs each year could well be cut from £20,000 to £12,000 at the budget tomorrow. Stephen Fine is the chief executive of the investment bank Peel Hunt. Stephen, morning.
Morning.
You're in the business of investing, advising people on investing. Will this change, if it came in, make people move their money out of a cash savings account and think, I'll put it into stocks and shares and invest in businesses in the UK?
Well, first of all, we don't advise individuals on what to do with their money. We're a corporate advisory firm for mid-cap and growth companies. But I think the whole concept of this is the ISA product and what it was originally designed to do and what it now does. And it's a fantastic, I'm all for the ISA product. I think it's a terrific product. A tax break for investment is a fantastic opportunity for individuals to get to know markets, get to understand risk better, and to deploy their savings in productive assets that can make a difference. Where it's changed is that we allow individuals to export capital by investing overseas and giving them a tax break for that. And we stand out a mile compared to other countries by offering a tax break on interest earned. Both of those, I think, are unusual.
And have you seen over the years a change in habits of the amount of money that is invested in British businesses, for example, because of that increasing threshold that we've seen?
Well, I think as markets have become more globalised, the opportunity to invest in overseas companies has become more interesting, understandably. But a tax break to invest overseas for individuals, to me, doesn't really sync with the initial concept of what the PEPs were when they first came out and they morphed into ISAs. Much the same as a tax break on interest earned should theoretically be much better for an individual if it was a tax break on interest paid. First-time buyers get a tax break on mortgage interest relief rather than a tax break on cash sitting in an ISA doing nothing. You could flip it around that way.
And so is this actual change going to make a difference? What do you think the biggest consequence of it will be?
I mean, first of all, there's a vested interest out there that likes the cash ISA product. It's a great way of garnering deposits in numerous organisations, whether they can be building societies, banks, retail brokers, or even spread betting firms offer cash ISAs. So I think there'll obviously be a vested interest there that will say, well, we want to keep them. But to be honest, moving it from 20 to 12,000, which is still £1,000 a month you can save in your cash ISA, is not an unfair allowance. And it's a start. And I think if we have this advice guidance boundary review, which the FCA are targeting to get retail more interested in investing, and we have a bit more focus on risk rather than focusing on costs and protection, it's all a start.
Can I ask you, as you are in the financial services world, have you, the story in Financial Times this morning, the city pressed to praise Reeves' budget as lenders win reprieve from tax rises, so there might not be the higher tax for banks than we've seen. Has that memo got to you to be lining up to praise the budget this week?
I haven't seen that. I wouldn't comment on it. But to be honest, my third wish is that this budget is disinflationary. The UK wants growth. If we can have a disinflationary budget that will allow the Independent Bank of England to look objectively at this and cut interest rates,
can I just ask you about
a big multiplier effect?
What disinflationary, you know, what that means for you? Because if we're seeing, for example, announcements that your rail tickets won't be going up, will be frozen, you know, people will say that isn't prices going up, but could well contribute to a disinflationary environment. Is that the way to do it? To say we are not going to increase the price of things?
I mean, that's a way of doing it. I mean, inflation comes in many guises. I think overall, if you look at the bond market and the way it's behaving, it's hoping that we're in an environment where inflation is coming down and therefore interest rates can come down. Interest rates coming down is probably one of the biggest stimulants for growth that we can have. So a disinflationary budget. Ideally, it would have been a single shock rather than a smorgasbord of rises, because I always find that's complicated and you can't please everybody. But if we can get that, then at least we can feel a bit more stable and we can start to plan. Unfortunately, when you've got long lengths of time between fiscal events, and we have had two of those, and hopefully we're going down to one of those per year, it just causes frustration and angst, anxiety, stress, and I guess all this speculation about what may or may not happen.
Stephen Fine, just another day or so of that. Thank you. Stephen Fine, Chief Executive of the investment bank Peel Hunt. At the Business Lobby Group, the CBI's annual conference yesterday, the Business Secretary, Peter Carl, was hinting there'd be extensive consultations about that employment's right bill we were talking about so much yesterday, claiming it was not a zero-sum game, whether either workers or bosses lost out. Louise McLean is the Business Development Director of Signature Group, a hospitality group with 700 staff across 24 venues in Scotland. Louise, morning. Does that ease your concerns that your business won't necessarily be hit in the way you've been feeling it might be?
I mean, I'm almost keen to hear sort of from the official stance point. Obviously, I know there's still aspects of the bill going through the House of Lords and for royal assent, but no business likes uncertainty. And as we're planning for 2026, which doesn't look like there's much more encouragement coming through the growth and the economy than 2025, we would prefer certainty as to how we can actually deal with the employee rights bill from April 26 going forward.
I mean, some of these things were always going to be not introduced and for a few years down the line until 2027, for example, the day one protection from unfair dismissal. So that might not be coming any sooner necessarily if you've got consultations, but just, you know, do you feel that the mood around the costs on business has changed, that actually there has been a, you know, particularly a year ago when we were talking about tax rises in the budget for a lot of businesses in hospitality especially, has there been something where you feel like you've been listened to and you won't feel that again this winter?
No, I don't, and I don't think that the budget from last year, that we're over the bruising of it. I mean, it was a decimation to the profit line in hospitality businesses. It was overwhelming. It wasn't, I mean, you know, a much coined phrase was survive 25, and we're limping to the end, but 2026 is not looking any brighter, and any more cost that is levied on our sector is just going to be increasingly painful.
When Stephen, as we were just talking to you there, was talking about a disinflationary budget, so, you know, pushing the, you know, downwards on inflation, not having prices rise as fast as they have been, do you feel like the hospitality industry is not going to be seeing the price rises that it might have seen through 2025?
We can't pass any more on to the consumer. We have absorbed so much of the costs that are levied at our business so that the customer is not paying at the till. We cannot, it's such a difficult equation. We cannot absorb all the costs, and yet the customer, the consumer, has a price on what they are prepared to pay for everything from a iced mocha latte right through to fish and chips. Everybody has a ceiling. And what we are seeing, certainly going into Christmas, is covers are up, so people are coming out, but spend per head is down. So people are saying, we don't want to stop going out, but we are going to stop spending quite so much money when we're out. So all that does is just mean our sales line doesn't get hit and our profit line is so compromised.
Louise, thank you. Louise McLean there, Business Development Director of Signature Group, with those 24 venues across Scotland. Sabitha Subramaniam is the Partner and Head of Investment Strategy at Saracen and Partners. Sabitha, very good morning to you. Revolut, the financial services company, not yet a fully fledged bank here in the UK, it wants to be, valued at $75 billion, more being reported, more than the value of Barclays at the minute, because Nvidia, the chip maker, has taken a stake. What's this tell us about Revolut?
Well, I mean, I think it just basically, it's one of the success stories of innovation in Britain, and it just shows the potential, how markets might reward a financial disruptor. Revolut has a very, you know, it's a leader in global financial technology. It's grown incredibly fast, and it's really disrupting existing banks in the UK.
What's that valuation based upon? We often talk about with new tech businesses about, you know, what it is that is driving investors to think it's worth that much. What do you think?
Well, I think the Nvidia stake suggests that, you know, there is certainly going to be an AI component and a push into financial technology. So I think the valuation is really reflecting sort of potential growth, probably, you know, not, you know, current earnings, but really where Revolut can go to in the future. And I think that's something that the market is rewarding, you know, future potential for disruption more than, you know, where you are today.
Can I ask you about Novo Nordisk? So this is the company behind the weight loss drug Ozempic. It said that the drug hadn't slowed the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And we saw the share price fall quite a bit yesterday. Are investors starting to get a little bit worried about this business?
I mean, I think the sort of, you know, the really sharp run-ups and the then, you know, sharp falls in prices is just really a reflection of the large amount of market volatility and the inability to really price, innovation in drugs. And I think it's reflective more of that and sort of the market conditions we are in today. I mean, I think expectations really seem to run far ahead of, probably what are realistic in the short term. So I think this is sort of reflective of that.
Sabitha, thank you. Sabitha Subramaniam from Saracen and Partners. I'll be back after 7.
Thank you very much indeed, Sean. It is 27 minutes past 6. Well, there was no football to report on. Have you got anything else to talk about,
Garth? No, not talking about football at all, apart from it being my top story, unfortunately, Nick. Sorry. The scoreline may have only been 1-0 as Everton beat Manchester United last night in the Premier League, but it was an eventful match. Everton went down to 10 men after just 13 minutes, with Idrissa Gueye sent off for striking his own teammate, Michael Keane. Gueye has apologised to Keane, his teammates and their fans, but the Everton manager, David Moyes, doesn't see it as a major issue.
I quite like it when my players have a bit of a brawl and a fight with each other, because it shows they care, shows they want to do better, you know, demands on players. And if we hadn't had that in the game tonight for long periods, demands and making sure we put each other under pressure to do the right thing, we might not have got a result.
The Champions League takes centre stage tonight with Chelsea hosting Barcelona. The Chelsea manager, Enzo Maresca, is aware that they need to treat it as any other game while facing the club that inspired him to become a manager.
I decided to be a manager because of a Pep team, Barcelona. I said many times that any club, any team can decide in the way they want to play. I chose the mine years ago, and this will be the way I like to watch my team playing football and also in the future.
There's commentary of Chelsea versus Barcelona at 8 p.m. tonight on 5Live and on Sports Extra. There's commentary of Manchester City hosting Bayer Leverkusen, while Newcastle United are away at Marseille, with the Newcastle boss Eddie Howe reminding his team that this is going to be a testing environment for us. Wilfred Nancy, currently head coach of Major League Soccer side Columbus Crews, is close to being appointed as the Celtic manager, according to BBC Scotland. The Scottish champions have been searching for a new manager since Brendan Rodgers resigned last month. The three-time Olympic gold medalist Max Whitlock is coming out of retirement to target a place at the Los Angeles Olympics in 2028. The 32-year-old, who is the most successful British gymnast in history, said that the 2024 Paris Games would be his last, but...
I'd done what I said, I'd stop after that one, and I fully retired, but something was just kind of itching away at me constantly. It has been for the last year. It just doesn't sit right. It feels unfinished. It feels like incomplete. So I feel like I've got an opportunity in front of me.
And in the last few seconds, the England and Chelsea goalkeeper Hannah Hampton has just been named the BBC's Women's Footballer of the Year for 2025. It has certainly been an eventful year for her.
It certainly has. Thank you very much, Carthy. It is exactly 6:30. Thursday's 6:30 comedy this week is a new sitcom by Travis J.
Guys, come on, listen. Family shouldn't fight like this. Love and forgiveness is key.
Award-winning sitcom, Rum Punch.
I never said you weren't interested.
But you clearly didn't say she was. Rookie mistake, big man.
Shut up, Des.
A close-knit family all trying to do their own thing, whilst also keeping the family restaurant alive.
All right, okay, hurrah.
Hey, what's the job then?
What do you mean?
You're using a full-blown job interview voice. Just to be sure. Hurrah.
Rum Punch.
No! Graham! Hilarious!
Starts on Thursday evening at 6:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The time now is indeed 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson, and Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
A US official has confirmed that a meeting with Russian representatives is taking place in Abu Dhabi as part of efforts to end the war in Ukraine. President Zelensky has welcomed changes to a US-backed peace plan following Ukraine's meeting with American representatives in Geneva. Sir Keir Starmer is also preparing to host a virtual meeting of Ukraine's allies today. Russian missiles and drones have been pounding the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, overnight. Officials say that six people have been killed and that two blocks of flats have been hit. Ukraine has also attacked Russia, with strikes reported in two southern regions. Rachel Reeves has urged Labour MPs to unite behind her forthcoming budget and has insisted that she will be Chancellor for years to come. She told a meeting of the parliamentary party that the measures announced tomorrow would be progressive, but she also warned of difficult choices. Nigel Farage has said that he has never directly racially abused anybody in response to allegations in The Guardian newspaper that he was racist and anti-Semitic towards pupils while at school. He said that the alleged incidents took place almost 50 years ago and that there was a strong political element to the accusations. Reform UK said that the allegations were entirely without foundation. Labour says he should come clean on claims over his past. The communications watchdog Ofcom has urged online technology companies to step up their efforts to tackle the trolling of online and online abuse of women. The regulator has published guidance, which includes measures such as prompts that ask users to reconsider before posting harmful content. And police forces are to prioritise trying to catch organised crime gangs that are targeting farms as part of a new crime strategy. The National Police Chiefs Council says that issues such as machinery theft strike at the heart of rural life. The National Farmers Union has welcomed the crackdown and has also called for more visible policing and tougher sentences.
Charles, thank you. It is coming up now to 27 minutes to 7. I'll show the media, I'll show the Tories, I will not let them beat me, the Chancellor told Labour MPs in a pre-budget briefing last night. Yep, there is just one day to go. Our chief political correspondent Henry Zeffman had his ear to the door in the House of Commons where that meeting took place. She's getting her defiance in first, is she, Rachel Reeves?
Yeah, very much so, Nick. And obviously the most important thing for this budget, for any budget, is what the general public make of it and how it affects the economy. But at a time when Rachel Reeves's economic and political judgment are being questioned by her own side like never before, I think it clearly also matters a lot how this budget is received by Labour MPs. I mean, her defiant address to the PLP yesterday went down pretty well, from what I can tell. She said, I'll be there on Wednesday, I'll be there next year, and I'll be back the year after that. And she also sought to frame the budget. She said it would be a Labour budget, a progressive budget. I think what was most interesting is a passage where she said the budget would be a package, not a pick and mix. She said you can't say, I like the cola bottles, but not the fruit salad. In other words, she's saying to Labour MPs, you're getting the abolition of the two-child benefit cap and other things that you want, but the trade-off is that there will be some things you're uneasy with. They all come together. That's what she wanted Labour MPs to have in their minds as they prepare for tomorrow.
And what Labour MPs also want is for Nigel Farage to be in hot water. And he has spoken out for the first time in any depth about allegations made that he racially abused people at school. And Mr. Farage, the Reform UK leader, used a curiously precise formulation to defend himself.
Yes, he did. This follows a Guardian story where more than a dozen of Nigel Farage's classmates at Dulwich College in the late 1970s and early 80s said that they witnessed offensive behaviour from him. One Jewish classmate claimed that Nigel Farage would tell him Hitler was right and gas them. A non-white pupil told the paper he was told by Nigel Farage to go back where he had come from. Now, Reform UK have said throughout that the allegations are entirely without foundation. But as you say, yesterday, Nigel Farage answered questions publicly about these allegations for the first time. And he said repeatedly, I've never directly racially abused anybody. He also said that he had probably misspoken in his younger days, but he said that his former classmates were not telling the truth. And as you say, a lot of political heat on Nigel Farage from his political rivals here. Labour calling on him to come clean. The Liberal Democrats saying these allegations are unbecoming from someone who wants to be our next Prime Minister. So a focus on Nigel Farage's personal conduct, even if historic here, which he will find very uncomfortable.
Mr. Farage talks about banter, talks about misspeaking. We'll hear much more of that interview after 7 o'clock. Henry Zeffman, thank you.
It is 25 to 7 now. Russian overnight strikes on Kyiv have killed at least 6 people. And of course, talks are continuing about the latest US proposed ceasefire deal. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beal is in Kyiv. Jonathan, what's been happening there overnight?
Well, we've had air raid warnings. We've had explosions. People have been running into the shelters. These attacks in Kyiv happen, I think the last one was about a week ago, so they do happen fairly regularly. But I think what it tells us all, and remember, it's not just Kyiv that's being hit, it's Odessa, and likewise Ukraine is carrying out its long-range strikes too against Russian oil installations, military sites, that this war, despite the talks, is nowhere near at an end. There is no breakthrough. Those talks are continuing, we know, but they certainly haven't had a breakthrough.
No. And on the point of those talks, Jonathan, we know that Ukraine and the US and Europe have been talking about trying to modify the initial leaked proposal. But actually, you've discovered there are other talks going on as well at the moment.
Yes. Yeah, so I've had a confirmation from a US official traveling with the US Army Secretary Dan Driscoll. He's the man who came to Kyiv last week, presented that draft plan, which included many, many Russian demands and which Ukraine found unacceptable and then managed to have those negotiations in Geneva. Interestingly, I was told by one a diplomat that the Americans, when they went in to see the Ukrainians, first wanted to make sure that Ukraine would praise President Trump's efforts and show gratitude. So it's interesting to see whether that's the same pattern that will happen when they meet the Russians in Abu Dhabi. So that same team is now meeting the Russian representatives, we're told, in Abu Dhabi to discuss what has been now discussed and changed dramatically in Geneva. And the truth is, if it's changed in Ukraine's favour, it will be undoubtedly less acceptable to Moscow.
Yeah, and that's one of the big sticking points, isn't it? Jonathan Beal in Kyiv, thank you, our defence correspondent. We'll hear from the EU's top diplomat, Kaya Kallas, after 8:10. She is very clear that that document should be weighted in favour of Ukraine and not in favour of Russia, in favour of the aggressor. She's really interesting on that point, actually, so you'll hear what she's got to say at 8:10.
Look forward to that. President Macron of France, incidentally, has just said we want peace, not capitulation, in comments that have just been reported by Reuters. It is now 22 minutes to 7. Ofcom has ordered social media companies to combat online misogyny by changing the algorithms that push hateful content to users. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, has been studying what the new guidelines do. These are an attempt, are they, Zoe, to crack down on what some call the manosphere?
They sort of are. That's right. Ofcom is trying here to tackle a huge problem that's just not going away, and that is the abuse and trolling that's experienced by women and girls on the internet. We hear time and time again that women and girls are more likely to be targeted. Last week, I met up with a sport influencer, and she told me she'd had to become resilient about comments that targeted her weight and her appearance. I also met the founder of a female running club for Muslim women, and she said she had a great community around her, but she still didn't feel safe online. Now, Ofcom is saying that this is not okay, along with a chorus of other voices. And what it's recommending, Nick, are really kind of practical steps for tech companies to take to make a difference. Let me give you an example of one of them. Things like being able to report multiple abusive comments at the same time, a bit like, you know, you'd select a bunch of emails to delete, maybe, rather than having to go to each one individually to report it, which, as you may well know, if you've had them, can be a really painful experience if you've got loads. But the problem is, Nick, that these are guidelines, they're not laws. And while the tech companies who comply are going to be publicly named by Ofcom, so we'll all be able to see who's doing it and, more importantly, who doesn't, there isn't a legal requirement for them to actually comply with this.
And what do Ofcom believe will act as an incentive for tech firms to actually adopt these guidelines?
Well, the tech firms themselves say that they take this seriously and that they want that, you know, that they're willing to be involved. And we have seen them comply with the Online Safety Act on the whole so far with things like age verification. And Ofcom hopes that the sort of the naming and shaming aspect is going to incentivise them a bit, I suppose. But plenty of critics say that this isn't enough. You know, we've already seen Ofcom under scrutiny over the impact of the Online Safety Act, which was years in the making and has now been law for 2 years. They've only fined two companies so far, quite small amounts. One of them, a company called 4chan, has just refused to pay. We've had the Technology Secretary Liz Kendall saying the regulator risks losing the public's trust if change doesn't happen more quickly. And particularly regarding summer, regarding sport, we've heard the chair of Sport England, the former cyclist Chris Boardman, he complained to Ofcom in the summer about the online abuse that's experienced by women's footballers. You may remember during the Euros, Jess Carton was basically forced off social media because of the racial abuse that she received. And he says that it just undermines all the attempts to encourage more women to take up sport because they're so alarmed by the response that they get online.
Zoe Kleiman, our technology editor, thank you.
The months of budget speculation are just about over. You'll be pleased to hear tomorrow is the big day, but there is a last hurrah on several of the front pages this morning about items that might make an appearance when Rachel Reeves stands up tomorrow. The Daily Express talks about pensioners in a battle to keep their homes warm. They're saying frozen income tax thresholds will lead to frozen homes. The iPaper talks about a possible mansion tax. That's another one that's been floated, causing Labour a world of trouble in the budget, warns a top economist. The Daily Mail reflecting this morning on something that Sean was talking about in the business news about half an hour ago. The slashing, says the paper, of the annual cash ISA limit from 20,000 to 12,000 to try and encourage people to put it in stocks and shares ISAs instead. And the FT has an interesting little tidbit that banks have apparently been asked to make prominent public endorsements of the budget this week. Treasury officials want lenders to praise policies and explain how they will be of benefit to people. And at the very least, they're told, please refrain from criticising government decisions.
Matt has, well, I always say he has the last word because he's my favourite cartoonist, but on the front page of the Telegraph has a guy in front of his telly saying to his wife, the budget speculation is too depressing. I'm watching a replay of the first Ashes Test. Depressing for owners of expensive houses. The iPaper leads with mansion tax will cause Labour a world of trouble in budget, warns top economist. That's our old friend Paul Johnson, formerly of the IFS, who says that, look, if one side of a council tax band is much more heavily taxed than another side of a council tax band, that will cause chaos as people try to get different valuations on their houses to avoid paying thousands of pounds. A lot of attention on Nigel Farage in the paper. Daily Mirror reports with the headline, catchy headline, any more Vlad Apples, Nigels. The mounting pressure it claims he's under to investigate pro-Putin links in reform. The Guardian continues with its reporting of those allegations we were just hearing about from Henry Zeffman of racial abuse school. We'll talk more about that later. And of course, the BBC makes I was about to say, of course, makes the front page. As you would expect, after a hearing that lasted many hours in the Commons yesterday, there to be a lot of coverage on it. In fact, there's only one paper, the paper that broke the original story of the memo, criticising the BBC's handling of its editorial standards. The Telegraph is the only paper that leads on it. BBC in disarray over bias claim, and it's editorial, it says, its conclusion on what we saw yesterday was there was a sense that the concern outlined in that memo, written by Michael Prescott, who gave evidence yesterday, was about process and not about culture. And what the Telegraph concludes in its editorial is the BBC must start taking bias seriously.
Your highlighting of which enables me to segue seamlessly into our next item, which is that the author of the leaked report, Michael Prescott, which led to the crisis facing the BBC, told MPs yesterday in Parliament that he had hoped his concerns would be dealt with privately. The Commons Culture, Media and Sport Committee also had a widespread apology from the chair of the BBC, as our parliamentary correspondent Susan Hume reports.
On a Monday afternoon in a Commons committee room, the kind of emotions were expressed that you'd expect in a BBC Sunday night drama.
Most people in this country, certainly myself included, might go as far as to say that they love the BBC.
The BBC really matters to me as an institution. I think it's extremely important.
I'm a passionate defender of the BBC. I'm a passionate defender of its values.
But despite all that love and passion, the BBC has just lost both its director general and its head of news, and is facing a $1 billion lawsuit from the US president. The crisis was triggered by a leaked memo from a former adviser, Michael Prescott, outlining where he felt the BBC had not dealt properly with editorial failings on race, trans issues, Israel, and an edit of a speech by President Trump. So for the first time since the row blew up, he explained his thinking to MPs.
We kept seeing incipient problems which I thought were not being tackled properly. And indeed, I thought the problems were getting worse.
The memo has been claimed by some as blowing the whistle on left-wing bias in the BBC. But Michael Prescott insisted there was no party politics at play, for example, over the Trump speech.
If it had found that it had been Kamala Harris misrepresented, not Donald Trump, I would have acted in exactly the same way, because I don't want the BBC's coverage skewed this way or that way. I just want it to be impartial, accurate and fair.
So the committee chair and Conservative MP, Dame Caroline Dynage, wondered...
Do you think the BBC is institutionally biased?
No, I don't. And I'm sure someone's going to correct me pretty quickly if I'm wrong, but I just reread the memo yet again outside the door here. I don't think I used that phrase anywhere in the memo.
And while there were these incipient problems, he took no pleasure in the resignation of senior figures such as Tim Davey.
For what little use or worth this is to him now... Firstly, I always liked the guy, and secondly, most importantly, to the extent that inexpert me can judge, he seemed to me to be doing a first-rate job across 80 or 90% of the portfolio. It was just that he had this blind spot on editorial failings. I think it's a bit of a tragedy he's gone. I thought he was a supreme talent, but he had this blind spot.
He told MPs he'd sent its memo to only 14 people across the media watchdog Ofcom and the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. Caroline Dynage asked gently...
Michael, were you pleased that your memo found its way into the...
No. Gosh.
You're surprised?
As I say, yeah, I was surprised.
The cameras were later turned off, and when they returned, the BBC chair, Samir Shah, was in the witness seat, and he wanted to make sure he got an apology in first.
Forgive me, I'd like to take this opportunity, first of all, to apologise to all the people who believe in the BBC and care for it and wish it to survive and thrive.
Those apologies went on for some time, ending...
I regret the mistakes that have been made and the impact that has had.
Alongside him was Sir Robbie Gibb, a member of the BBC board. He used to be a senior BBC editor and was also a communications chief for the Conservatives. Caroline Dynage asked him about rumours that this was a concerted effort to tackle left-wing bias at the BEEB.
Was there anything orchestrated about what's happened to the BBC over the last couple of weeks, the departure of Tim Davey, etc.?
It's up there as one of the most ridiculous charges. People had to find some angle. It's complete nonsense. It's also deeply offensive to fellow board members who are, as Samir was saying, are people of great standing in different fields. The idea that somehow I'm not even sure what the charge is, to be honest, and basically other than to say it's complete nonsense.
Labour's Natasha Irons was not convinced.
Sir Rugby, so you've clearly a man of very strong political convictions and have held multiple posts both at the BBC and then over at Number 10 for the last couple of decades. And how have you managed to keep these roles separate and managed your own bias?
Sir Robbie Gibbs said he'd spent 25 years as a BBC journalist. Impartiality was drummed into him and he was feeling unfairly politicised.
There couldn't be a bigger mismatch between the way I'm presented in some quarters in relation to my attitude. I'd become weaponised.
The hearing lasted for nearly 3.5 hours. Finally...
Is there any further messages that you want to leave us with?
No, I think that's fine. You've
had enough. OK. Thank you very much for everyone's time today. Order.
That was the end, but it's not all over yet.
Susan Hume reporting, not all over yet, because last night on Radio 4, the chair of that committee said that the BBC was not in safe hands. And I quote, that was Caroline Dynage of the Select Committee. It is now 11 minutes to 7. Fighting organised crime gangs that are targeting farms is to be made a key priority in a new 3-year rural crime strategy for the UK's police forces. That is welcome news for the National Farmers Union. Let's talk to their Vice President, Rachel Hallos. Morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, but your farmers and your members are clearly deeply worried about what? Organised criminal gangs stealing their equipment.
Yeah, no, things have moved on, haven't they, since how they used to be. This is what's happening on farms. We've got big GPS units going. We've got people that are staking farms out. And there's huge concerns about this. So I'm really, really pleased to see this as an important part of the new rural crime strategy. It's a crazy world that we're living in when rural farms, isolated farms, have been targeted by some very, very serious criminals.
But as you mentioned GPS, this is presumably partly a reflection on the fact that even a small farm might have some quite expensive electronic kit on it.
Yes, it is. And farmers are taking more preventative measures, you know, more security cameras, and they're being more careful. But ultimately, these have been stolen to order. And it's not just GPS units, it's fuel, it's other items, equipment itself. There's a huge demand for second-hand equipment around the world, and it literally gets ordered, taken and shipped away.
Around the world. So, in other words, people are, in the way they do with cars, for example, they are rebadging what tractors, other heavy machinery, having it shipped across the world in order to sell for thousands of pounds.
Yeah, there is evidence that that is happening as well. So when we're talking about serious crime, we really, really do mean this. And there's also other links to other elements of serious crime, such as when you talk about hair coursing. This is not just some people having some fun with a dog. This is targeted. There is huge financial rewards behind this. And quite often there are links with other elements of serious crime as well.
Now, how can the police realistically protect thousands of small, potentially isolated farms? How is it practical for them to do more?
Crikey, yeah, it's a really, really good question. And ultimately, I think what farmers are looking for, and actually we've had conversation with police crime commissioners as well, it's that equality in funding for rural policing and also that visibility of police out there on the road, not just for farmers, but for other people that are doing that, staking out of farms, if you like. We appreciate that the police are under extreme pressure financially, completely understand that. But we think that this is something that is really important because this crime funds other crime elsewhere.
Rachel Hallos of the National Farmers Union, thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow afternoon, we will know the answers for sure. But another leaked suggestion about what will be in the budget has universities paying a tax on international student fees. The government thinking is that that money would then go to help fund poorer students from the UK. But the institutions are concerned that this would be counterproductive. Vivian Stern joins us, the Chief Executive of Universities UK. Good morning.
Morning.
So if the money comes out of international student fees, but then goes back into helping UK students, it would in theory get to you anyway. So what is your worry here?
Well, look, I don't want to bash the government. It's a hard job and they've been doing some really difficult things and they've done some good things to help both universities stabilise their finances, but also help students. They made some good announcements yesterday on research funding. They took a really tough decision to increase the domestic fee in line with inflation a couple of months ago. And as you say, giving students from the poorest backgrounds extra financial help is something that we really want them to do. It's a hard thing to work out how to fund that. The problem is a kind of right-hand, left-hand problem. This tax on international students, fundamentally, it makes me want to bang my forehead on the desk because in essence, it'll take £780 million away from English universities.
It's not going to be funneled back in through being given to those students who will then pay it back to universities.
Well, look, some of the money is going to be spent on a grant for a subset of students. We don't know how many. Introducing grants as a whole for all students from low-income backgrounds would cost about $3 billion. So it certainly won't be for all poor students. The government said they want to put some money into a small number of students who are studying priority subjects and some unspecified things on skills. But the point is, the money is coming away from universities who are spending it on students as it is, right? So we know that universities don't receive the money that it costs to teach a student. Can I give you an example? So like, say you've got a pet, right? You want a vet. A vet costs about £20,000 to train. The universities get about £10,000 through a combination of the cap tuition fee, £9,500, and a little bit of a top-up from government grants. So they have to find effectively the other £10,000.
They do, but Vivienne, if I may, just at this point, because we're talking about this money coming from international students who pay four, five, six times that amount. They pay
more. So the way that say the Royal Veterinary College makes up for the fact that it costs them twice as much to train a vet as they get in income for UK students is to attract international students. And we're really good at that, right? International students love coming to the UK because we've got a great university system. And that allows us to provide the high quality education that we need to provide to the UK student and all of the other things, you know. So universities themselves have been putting money that they earn from other sources, including international fees, into supporting students on their own campus. I was talking to one university that was saying, look, we provide bursaries to our students now, those students who come to us. We're probably not going to be able to afford to do that. That university is going to get sort of slapped with a £25 million cost as a result of this levy. It's a huge amount of money for a big institution. And the point is, that's not money that universities are sort of stuffing down the back of the sofa. They're putting it into the education of UK students and doing research, which they also don't get the full cost of. And that really is just putting money in, you know, it's taking money with one hand and giving money with one hand and taking away with the other. And it's just pointless. It means that decision, for example, to increase the domestic tuition fee, which will bring about £430 million into the university sector, will be more than wiped out by the decision to levy this tax. So it's a counterproductive decision. I know that the decision is made, and I understand how much pressure the government's under, and I understand that it's hard finding money to do the things that they want to do, like introducing grants.
Vivienne
but this
Stern,
measure is counterproductive.
Thank you for being with us, Chief Executive of Universities UK. The government, well, the Department for Education do say further details will be set out in the budget, but that's their main point, that putting the levy on international students will allow them to give maintenance grants back to more British students from poorer backgrounds.
The stories we tell.
About the people we know.
And the places we love.
Are not just made here.
They're stories made of here.
The British Isles are globally important for nature.
Yeah, we might find that kid who's got the raw talent, who's in a back street in Preston somewhere. That'd be amazing.
The thing is,
we're moving back to Barry.
What? Be
my home. Made of Belfast.
Liverpool. Cornwall. Glasgow.
Newcastle.
Cardiff.
Made of here.
Because this is our BBC.
Time for the weather now. Here's Helen Willetts.
Nick, thanks very much. Hello there. We've a ridge of high pressure moving in today, which means a more settled day for many of us. Not for all. There are still a few showers around. Let's start the detail across England and Wales. And it's in the east and the west where we have the showers. So across the Llyn Peninsula of Wales, Pembrokeshire and in Cornwall. We've got a Pembrokeshire dangler that just brings showers down from the north on that breeze throughout the day. And further east, we've got showers for southeast England, parts of East Anglia, more isolated in these areas, but fairly frequent for eastern coastal counties of the northeast of England right now. Little wintry over the tops of the North York Moors. In between, plenty of dry, cold, even frosty weather this morning with a bit of patchy mist and fog. But that's where we'll see the lion's share of the sunshine. And actually through the day elsewhere, those showers will tend to ease away. Still a brisk wind across East Anglia in the southeast, obviously tempering the feel of the day and temperature will be down on yesterday around about 6 to 9 degrees Celsius. So despite the sunshine, still feeling chilly. Frosty start for parts of Northern Ireland. One or two showers around here, so icy patches are a concern, but temperatures getting up to 7 to 10 degrees, plenty of sunshine. And for Scotland as well, plenty of sunshine. It's a frosty start, icy patches are a concern, -5 in the Highlands, just a few showers scattered around coastal counties, really plenty of sunshine to come.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 25th of November. The headlines this morning, US officials say they are now meeting a Russian delegation in Abu Dhabi to discuss the latest Ukraine peace plan. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has told Labour MPs that they may not like every measure in the budget, describing it as a package, not a pick and mix. And tech firms are being urged to adopt UK guidelines intended to tackle the online abuse of women and girls.
Coming up in the next hour, we tell the remarkable story of Polly, the golden retriever who saved its owner's life by barking when he had a heart attack.
I would say Polly knew before it was even happening. She was just, it was like, I'd say Adam had just started the arrest as she barked.
Wales is home to thousands of rare species, but a new report warns many are hanging by a thread. We'll hear from the man trying to change all that. That's after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
A US official has told BBC News that an American delegation is meeting Russian representatives in Abu Dhabi to discuss proposals to end the war in Ukraine. The talks are the latest attempt by the Trump administration to bridge the gap between Russia and Ukraine. On the ground, drone and missile attacks have killed at least 6 people in Kyiv. Our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, is there and sent this report.
It was another night of heavy Russian strikes, including in the capital, Kyiv. Proof there is no diplomatic breakthrough and no end to the war in sight. But after the talks in Geneva, Ukraine appears to have a peace plan it can work with. It's significantly different from the version presented by the US last week, which included many Russian demands, such as Ukraine giving up more of its territory. President Zelensky said the new draft had many of the right elements. Europe, too, is working to strengthen his position, with Sir Keir Starmer today hosting a virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing. But that's all likely to mean it's less acceptable to Moscow. US officials are meeting Russian representatives today in Abu Dhabi.
Russian officials say that Ukrainian drone attacks have killed 3 people and wounded 10 more in the Rostov region on the border between the two countries. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, has told this programme that the peace negotiations should not see Russia rewarded.
We can't go back to business as usual. I mean, how can you possibly imagine that? All the destruction, all the killing that they have done, and also, I mean, all the breaches of the international law, and then we just look away and say, oh, it's nothing. We just go and continue as before.
Rachel Reeves has delivered a defiant message to Labour MPs ahead of her budget tomorrow, telling them that she will be Chancellor for years to come and that they must stick together if they want to win the next election. She promised she would announce a Labour budget that was progressive, but she also warned of tough choices. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Politics is a team sport, Rachel Reeves told restive Labour MPs last night. The need for that reminder is a sign of just how fraught some of the build-up to this budget has been. With growing questions about Labour's leadership, the Chancellor told the party it must stick together in order to win the next election and promised she would still be in the job next year and the year after. But Ms Reeves warned of difficult choices in tomorrow's budget and told MPs they might not like every measure she announces. It's a package, not a pick and mix, she said. There were hints of more money for the NHS and measures to curb inflation. Rachel was strong and honest, one convinced MP said afterwards. Others were not so sure and said her pleas for unity sounded desperate.
Nigel Farage has said that he has never directly racially abused anybody in response to allegations in The Guardian newspaper that he was racist and anti-Semitic towards pupils while at school. The Reform UK leader said the alleged incident took place almost 50 years ago and that there was a strong political element to the claims. He said his former classmates were not telling the truth, but that he said that things could be interpreted as banter in the playground. Our political correspondent, Joe Pike, reports.
More than a dozen pupils told The Guardian they witnessed offensive behaviour from Nigel Farage while he was at London's Dulwich College in the late 70s and early 80s. One Jewish classmate claimed that Mr Farage would tell him Hitler was right and gas them. A non-white pupil told the paper he was targeted by Nigel Farage and told to go back where he'd come from. Reform UK said the allegations were entirely without foundation. This was the first time Mr Farage answered questions publicly about the claims.
I never directly racially abused anybody, no.
Again, define directly for me. What do you mean by directly?
By taking it out on an individual on the basis of who they are or what they are, no.
Again, taking it out on somebody is different to... It's different to saying
stuff
to somebody.
Have I ever misspoken in my life, in my younger days, when I was a child? Probably.
Labour has said Mr Farage should finally come clean on claims over his past and apologise to those who bravely spoke out. The Liberal Democrats said the Reform leader's refusal to completely deny the racist remarks is unbecoming from someone who wants to be our next Prime Minister.
Tech firms are being urged to adopt new guidelines aimed at protecting women and girls in the UK from abuse online. The regulator Ofcom says the measures go above and beyond what's needed to comply with the law. It says women should not have to think twice before expressing themselves online, nor face relentless trolling for simply doing their jobs. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Ofcom's new guidelines are not a legal requirement, but the regulator says it'll publicly name the tech companies which choose to adopt them. They're practical and include recommendations such as enabling the multiple blocking of abusive comments in one go rather than having to go through them all individually, demonetising content that contains sexual violence, and nudging social media users whose posts are flagged as abusive or misogynistic before they're published. But the watchdog has already faced criticism that it lacks teeth. So far, it's issued just two fines for non-compliance with the Online Safety Act. One of them was given to the platform 4chan, which has refused to pay it.
A study has identified the rarest species in Wales, based on the number of places they can be found. It's the first time such an approach has been used in the UK. According to the environmental body Natural Resources Wales, just under 3,000 species, from fungi to flies, exist in five locations or fewer. Of these, 1,200 are found in only one site. Here's our Wales correspondent, Hal Griffith.
From the Snowdon lily that grows only in the Eryri mountain range to the glutinous snail that can only be found slithering along the shores of Llyn Tegid Lake, the report lists the different rare species it says are in peril. Some, such as the Arctic Alpine pea mussel, are in danger of extinction. Others, such as the bith-eye beast millipede, are relatively recent discoveries. All, according to Natural Resources Wales, need to be protected by reversing the decline in biodiversity. The environmental watchdog says this can be done cost-effectively with simple measures, such as trimming vegetation to open up space and saving older, veteran trees from being cut down.
China has sent a spacecraft to rescue stranded astronauts on its Tiangong space station. The crew's original vessel was given to the previous team after theirs was damaged by space debris. The China Space Agency said the astronauts were, in its words, functioning normally and in good condition. And a golden retriever from County Fermanagh will be honoured today as one of the British Heart Foundation's CPR heroes for helping to save the life of one of her owners. A bark from four-year-old Polly woke Adam Cook's wife Hannah, who was then able to perform emergency resuscitation on him until an ambulance arrived at their home in Enniskillen. Our Ireland correspondent Sarah Gervin takes up the story.
Last year, Adam Cook had a cardiac arrest in his sleep. He was just 37. The couple are convinced that Polly sensed her owner was very ill and raised the alarm. Adam was later diagnosed with dilated cardiomyopathy. He believes he's alive thanks to Polly and Hannah, and nominated them both for the British Heart Foundation's annual Heart Hero Awards. They've both been named as CPR heroes. So how is Polly coping with all the attention? Hannah says, very well.
She runs this house and she probably always will, as long as we're blessed with her.
Hannah says it wasn't much, just teamwork.
Sarah Gervin reporting.
Thank you, Charles. It's 9 minutes past seven now. President Zelensky has welcomed it. Russia says it's completely unconstructive. That is the view of the amended US plan to end the war in Ukraine after 2 days of talks to try and make it closer to something that Kyiv could accept. Remember, of course, that the Kremlin had welcomed the leaked first version of the plan, which was heavily in its favour, offering things like a return to the G8 and a lifting of all sanctions. But Ukraine was equally strongly against the proposed recognition of land, for example, even land which is in its own hands at the moment, which would become Russian. France's President Macron has said in the last hour that he wants peace, but not something that would represent a capitulation. And a US official has told BBC News this morning that an American delegation is also meeting Russian representatives in Abu Dhabi later today. Well, I spoke earlier to Tom Bateman, our State Department correspondent, about the current US view of the deal.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the Thursday deadline that leaked last week and was then confirmed by President Trump, I think, is evaporating, which will be some better news for the Europeans and the Ukrainians, obviously. But that, you know, the expressions I'm now hearing that, you know, they want the deal done as soon as possible, as quickly as possible. But that idea that they could get an agreement to all of this by, you know, it's now Tuesday morning, in 2 days' time, I think there is a recognition that that was always completely unrealistic. And the sense that there was an ultimatum bundled in with that, that US weapons supply and intelligence sharing would again be withdrawn after that happened temporarily back in March. I think also there is a realization that although that was, my understanding is that was communicated to the Ukrainians last week, but that seemed that sort of cloud seems to be lifting as well. So there's a bit more breathing space for the Ukrainians and the Europeans in this, but the reality remains that the pressure is still on Kyiv and the expectation is still on Kyiv. So, you know, what we were hearing from President Zelensky last night, that they feel like they've got more of their agenda back on the table, more of what he called the correct items into this, inserted into this peace plan. It's still not, you know, everything they want and need. And critically, I mean, we haven't seen the full draft, or the current draft, as it's now been put together after the Geneva talks. But clearly, it's not, you know, it's not where the Ukrainians want it yet. And so the Americans are maintaining this pressure to try and get the Ukrainians to agree to something. And as they've also been saying, the Russians have a vote, and that's basically the next vote, because presumably once they've dotted the I's and cross the T's on the discussions with the Ukrainians, it then goes back to Moscow.
Yeah, and this is the point, Tom, at which we've seen things fall down before, these moments of momentum that then start to crumble. Because if that deal presumably moves too far away from what Moscow wants, then it will simply reject it in its new form.
It will. And, you know, I think the crucial thing that we're hearing on territory, what the European counter proposal said, which was to do the thing that the Europeans have always demanded, which was an effective freeze on the line of contacts. But Ukraine committing not to try to recover the Russian occupied territory, or to only try to recover it through diplomatic means. So that is effectively the concession that Russia gets to keep the territory it currently occupies, and that has been a red line for them, along with many other things that are also totally unpalatable to the Ukrainians. And I think that brings us back to this idea of a pattern that we've seen throughout the course of the last 9 or 10 months, which has been that the Americans, via the envoy Steve Witkoff, have tended to go to the Russians, get a list of their demands and their positions, brief those to President Trump, sort of create this idea that that in itself is momentum towards a peace deal. And then, you know, when they've got the reaction of the Europeans and the Ukrainians, realize that it's totally unworkable. So you have a totally unbridgeable gap. But then the question was always, you know, when would Mr. Trump lose patience with the whole process? And that was the moment we reached last week. Now, I think, you know, after Geneva, the Europeans have a bit more breathing space, as I say, because they can feel like this isn't the week-long ultimatum that they were being given last week. But it's still pretty critical, I think, for the Ukrainians at this moment. And I think the fact that they are concerned about some of his political problems at home, and that is all adding on pressure to just get this off his plate. And I think that's what he was telling Steve Witkoff, J.D. Vance, and this Secretary of the Army, Dan Driscoll, who suddenly became engaged in this process in the last couple of weeks and have a far more hawkish position on Ukraine than somebody like the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who's always been traditionally more hawkish on Russia. And interestingly, he was the person that seemed to be dominating things in Geneva.
Tom Bateman in Washington, thank you.
It's 7:14 now. I have never directly racially abused anybody. The carefully chosen words of Nigel Farage last night in a response to an investigation by The Guardian, which revealed that 20 people who were at school with the leader of Reform UK alleged that he'd made racist or anti-Semitic remarks to them. Now, the claims are not entirely new. They build on Michael Crick's biography of Farage, published 3 years ago, which revealed that teachers at Dulwich College had warned against making him a prefect because of what they described as Mr. Farage's, and I quote, publicly professed racist and neo-fascist views. Mr. Farage says in a memoir he published after that biography that he had offended some people as he was a great admirer of Enoch Powell. Let's try to make sense of what we now know with our political investigations correspondent, Joe Pike, who's been doing some of his own digging into this story. Morning to you, Joe. What exactly have The Guardian so far revealed?
What they have done, Nick, is bring new on-record named sources and off-record allegations, building on what Michael Crick revealed in his original report about 12 years ago on television, but also, as you say, that 2022 biography where there were allegations about offensive behaviour. And some of the names in the Guardian report are the same as what Michael Crick has reported, but the Guardian have, as I say, added some new allegations. The headline is racism and anti-Semitism, even though Reform, of course, have responded. These claims are entirely without foundation. One Jewish classmate of Mr. Farage said that Farage would tell him Hitler was right and gas them. And a non-white pupil also told The Guardian he was targeted by Nigel Farage and told to go back where he'd come from. Now, there are many other allegations from the paper that Reform UK, as I say, has dismissed. But last night, Nigel Farage was attending a party event in Wales. It was the first time he was questioned on the record. The person talking to him on behalf of all UK broadcasters was BBC Wales's political editor, Gareth Lewis.
This is 49 years ago, by the way. 49 years ago. Have I ever tried to take it out on any individual on the basis of where they're from? No.
At school, categorically on the record, you did not racially abuse fellow pupils?
I would never, ever do it in a hurtful or insulting way.
That's not quite the same as not doing it.
It's 49 years ago. It's 49 years ago.
What difference is it? What difference is the time?
Isn't it? Well, you know, I just entered my teens. Can I remember everything that happened at school? No, I can't. Have I ever been part of an extremist organisation or engaged in direct, unpleasant personal abuse, genuine abuse, on that basis? No.
You're not quite. That's very, very caveated. You're not quite ruling this out. The question is, did you ever racially abuse fellow pupils in school?
No.
You've caveated
not
it with
intent.
A hurtful way.
Not with intent.
What do you
have
mean,
ever,
what do you mean not
I
with intent? I don't understand what you mean by
no,
not with intent. What does that mean?
You wouldn't do.
But what does that mean?
No.
No what?
No. I have never directly really tried to go and hurt anybody.
You're opening the door there to perhaps you did it without meaning to offend.
Have I said things 50 years ago that you could interpret as being banter in a playground, that you could interpret in the modern light of day in some sort of way? Yes. But isn't it funny?
OK, so you did say stuff to these people then?
I've never directly racially abused anybody, no.
Again, define directly for me. What do you mean by directly?
By taking it out on an individual on the basis of who they are or what they are, no.
Again, taking it out on somebody is different to... It's different to saying
stuff
to somebody.
Have I ever misspoken in my life, in my younger days, when I was a child? Probably.
So, that the people then who've made these allegations...
Yeah, they've got good memories, haven't they?
Well, they're telling the truth, are they?
They've got good memories, haven't they?
Are they telling the truth, Mr.
Well, suddenly, after 49 years, they seem to have perfect recollection. I would say to you, there is a strong political element to this.
Well, there we are. We hear Nigel Farage claiming that there is a strong political element. These are very old allegations. He can't remember everything from when he was a schoolboy. And if he did misspeak, to use his words, if there was banter, it was not directed at any individual. He clearly wasn't very comfortable, Joe, though, was he?
He wasn't, and I think his approach slightly changed across the interview. He was querying the memories, he was querying the political motivation, and he was also querying the honesty of some of those former fellow school pupils at Dulwich College in the late 70s and early 80s. But also, as we've heard, he did concede that he may have taken place in what he characterised in playground banter. As I say, these allegations, or at least some of them, have been around for 13 years, although, as Mr. Farage points out, this is almost 50 years ago that these alleged incidents took place. Ultimately, I suppose it's up to voters to decide who to believe and what the significance of all of this. And the big question, if we step back, is should we judge people based on what they did or maybe didn't do when they were young? The best comparison, I suppose, politically to this sort of scrutiny would be of David Cameron and Boris Johnson, their time at Oxford University, their membership of the controversial Bullingdon Club. When we are talking about potential prime ministers, their school days and their university days come under scrutiny because I suppose, as Michael Crick might argue, you often see signs of people's characters and their principles from the early years, which of course can shape their later professional life.
You can see that in a sense what Mr. Farage is trying to say is, look, it's the Guardian, they don't like me, these people don't like me, they're speaking out after I am now a candidate to be Prime Minister. But what strikes me is that even the critics of reform on the right, including the Conservative Party, are jumping on this. The Conservative Party chairman did a highly controversial tweet yesterday making links with Nazis.
Absolutely. Quote tweeting a tweet of a gold badge that Reform UK had posted, and linking it to a Wikipedia page linked to the Nazi Party. I mean, the Conservative Party is certainly changing their approach. Initially, Kemi Badenoch's team's view was to ignore Nigel Farage. Now they have a three-pronged attack, I'm told, which is about attacking the credibility, what they call the one-man band nature of Reform UK, but also, especially post the Nathan Gill sentencing last week, that former Reform Wales leader who's been convicted of taking money for making pro-Russian statements, attacking Reform UK on national scrutiny. So different political parties on the right and left, Nick, are being far more aggressive in their approach to reform. I suppose that's because reform have been leading the opinion polls since April, and that scrutiny is unlikely to stop.
It certainly is. Joe Pye, thank you very much indeed.
It's 21 minutes past seven. EasyJet, the low-cost airline, has seen its profits rise in the last year. Sean Farrington's back, and you've got the boss with you, Sean.
Yes, sales up at EasyJet to over £10 billion in the year to September. Profits up almost 10% as well to over £660 million. When we look at pre-tax profit, I've got the EasyJet Chief Executive Kenton Jarvis with me. A morning to you. Are customers booking with more or less confidence at the moment?
We're seeing really good demand. Hi, Sean. We're seeing really good demand. As you said, this is our third successive year of earnings growth. We announced new medium-term targets a couple of years ago and have grown profits 46% since then. And this year, we saw our profits rise, profit before tax rise 9%. So We are seeing an increase in customer demand. The airline flew 3.7 million more customers year on year. EasyJet Holidays did exceptionally well, reached its medium-term target 2 years early, posting 250 million, and had a 20% increase in customers during the year. So from what happened through the year, EasyJet certainly flew more people, flew them further and took them on holiday as well.
You say in your results this morning that improving profits has been more challenging than you previously thought, partly because of wider geopolitical or economic conditions. Has that been in the UK?
Well, no. I mean, part of that obviously is having two wars in the network in the Ukraine and in the Middle East. It means during the winter we're not able to fly to Tel Aviv or Jordan or some of the destinations that were previously interesting for our customers. But we've done is grown capacity, particularly in the winter, actually, to drive an improvement in productivity, which we saw in terms of both our crew productivity rising 6% in the winter and our aircraft utilization rising 5%. What happens when things happening that remove certain destinations, it did lead to a kind of industry-wide increase in capacity in Spain. So those Spanish routes, the Canaries, etc., took more supply than they might otherwise have done. And that's where we saw some of the pricing pressure.
Right. And I know you don't fly from Heathrow, but if Heathrow Airport's own proposal for a third runway, which involves moving the M25, was the approach taken, it's been reported, we may well find that out today. Is that the right approach?
Well, I haven't seen the details of the two schemes, so I think I'll leave that one with Heathrow and the government. But what I would encourage is that when they do that construction, they really think about the opportunity of having a low-cost carrier operating out of Heathrow, because there isn't really one today, and it will be great for customer choice. It will be great for a competitive fare environment. And it really is probably one of the few capital airports we don't have. We operate out of Schiphol, we operate out of Linate in Milan, we operate out of out of Paris Orly, and in London we have 100 aircraft in Gatwick, Luton and Stansted.
Could be an opportunity for you.
It would be an opportunity, 100%.
Kenton Jarvis, EasyJet Chief Executive.
Oh, you got a bit cut off there. Sean, thank you very much indeed. It is 25 minutes past seven. Thousands of species are at risk of extinction because they only exist in a small number of places which are highly vulnerable to habitat loss, climate change, storms or wildfires. That's the finding of a new first-of-its-kind report into biodiversity carried out by Natural Resources Wales. And we can talk to their strategic projects manager, Nick Thomas, now. I'm interested by this description, first-of-its-kind, Mr. Thomas. Morning to you, by the way. In what way are you doing something that hasn't been done before?
Well, we've assessed all of Wales's rarer species and looked at their geographic distribution and have found that about 3,000 of them are found at only five locations across Wales, and indeed 1,260 are found at single locations. So this is the first time on a country basis in the UK that this kind of spatial assessment of species has been carried out. So it is a first. It's also revealed, of course, how vulnerable many of these species are to the threat of climate change, habitat loss, pollution, etc. So it's great that we've done this piece of work, but it is also worrying that so many species are so vulnerable to the various threats we're facing nowadays.
And vulnerable in particular because they're geographically concentrated. In other words, if one part of that species is hit, they're all hit.
Well, that's right. You can imagine we've got one site, Newborough on Anglesey, Newborough Forest and Warren, which is the site with the most rare species in Wales. It's got 130 different species which are found at five locations or less. Last summer, we had a couple of fires there. Well, you can imagine a major fire at Newborough could be really catastrophic for many of these rare species, could wipe out some of them from Wales, indeed. So the fact that they're so geographically concentrated is worrying. The report's important in that it actually gives us some focus now. We've been doing lots and lots of work on rare species for many years. We've got some great programmes like Natarambith and the Nature Next Works programme funded by the Welsh Government at the moment going on. Many of our partners are doing loads of good work. But it gives us further focus to look at the most important sites and make sure we're carrying out the often not that expensive work that can turn around the fortune of many of these species and actually get them to start to spread out rather than contract as they have been doing in many cases for many years.
And tell us about one of these rare species, really rare ones, I know, that you've found that you're so keen to preserve.
Well, one of the things that, you know, of course, everybody knows Wales has got is some moderately high mountains. So we've got some really rare Arctic alpine species, things like the Snowdon lily, for example, or the Snowdon rainbow beetle, an absolutely incredibly colourful beetle only found on the summit of a Wythar, Snowdon. And of course, they're really threatened by climate change. As the climate warms up, you know, their fate is really in the balance. However, if we can get other things right, like grazing levels right in these mountain areas, we can probably hold on to them. So if it's really helped this report in giving us focus for the future, what we need to do in order to prevent these species going extinct.
Nick Thomas, Strategic Projects Manager at Natural Resources Wales, thanks for joining us.
28 minutes past seven. Carthy is back with the sport.
Morning, thank you very much. Everton beat Manchester United 1-0 last night in the Premier League, but the score wasn't the talking point. Everton went down to 10 men after just 13 minutes when Idrissa Gueye was sent off for striking his own teammate, Michael Keane. More of a slap, really, and has since apologised to Keane, his teammates and their fans. In the Champions League tonight, Chelsea host five-time winners Barcelona at 8 p.m. There's commentary on 5 Live. We'll be speaking to Gianfranco Zola in the next hour. On Sports Extra, there's commentary of Manchester City hosting Bayer Leverkusen, while Newcastle United are away at Marseille. Now, Wilfred Nancy, currently head coach of Major League Soccer side Columbus Crews, is close to being appointed as the Celtic manager. Let's speak to BBC Scotland's Gavin Wallace. Gavin, the Scottish champions have been searching for a new manager since Brendan Rodgers resigned last month. What are Nancy's credentials for the role?
Well, things are quite an advanced stage when it comes to the talks at the moment, but he headed over to Canada in 2021. Carthy, he took over at CF Montreal following Thierry Henry's resignation, led them to the Canadian Championship later that year. He then headed out to Ohio to Crew, and he's won the likes of the MLS Cup and the Leagues Cup. Now, that's a competition between Mexican and United States sides as well, and he's also been named MLS Coach of the Year. However, this year they finished 7th in the Eastern Conference and 12th overall. But he's overseen over 215 games, and really it would be quite a good move for Celtic, and it does seem as if this might happen kind of imminently.
Yeah, interesting appointment. Last week, Celtic's annual meeting was abandoned when shareholders were jeering constantly. There are, and have been for a while, tensions between the club and the supporters. I presume those tensions can't be fixed immediately by what's happening on the pitch, but how has it got to this point?
Yeah, it's really at a stage where I'm not entirely sure it can be fixed. Yeah, I think Celtic could win the Champions League and they would still want the board out at the moment. Such are the tensions that you may have seen the videos from the EGM where all the red cards went up. Peter Lowell himself had said that things have not been great at Celtic. They've been underperforming, underachieving, and to be honest, I'm not entirely sure I can see. I mean, don't get me wrong, winning on the park is ultimately what every football club wants to do, and that always papers over cracks, but that's all it does. It just fills the cracks a little bit. But those tensions are still going to be there, I think, no matter if Wilfred Nancy comes in and starts winning games and championships.
And it isn't just Celtic with these issues. Rangers yesterday sacked their chief executive Patrick Stewart and their sporting director Kevin Thirlwell, both with immediate effect. What's happening at Rangers?
Well, it's like green cheese can't be seen going by the other one at the moment, I don't think. There has to be drama somewhere, and it always happens with both clubs in Glasgow at the same time at the moment, I think. Yeah, Rangers saying that those two that you've just mentioned, Stewart and Thirlwell, their visions don't align with the club's visions is effectively what they've said. It will please everybody of a Rangers disposition. The two men have been under a lot of pressure recently. There's been signings that nobody likes, the whole Russell Martin thing, Rangers severely underperforming. You know, Danny Rowell has come in. I wonder if he has maybe had a part in this and perhaps doesn't get on with them either or doesn't like what they do. So I just find that a little bit, you know, the timing right now, a bit strange with that. But at the end of the day, it's not been good enough. Yeah. And Rangers fans now, well, they'll be a lot happier this morning, and it's a chance for Rangers to re-recruit a new chief executive, a new head of football, a head of sporting operations, as it yep. were, and perhaps start to kick on again.
Great. Gavin Wallace, thank you very much for explaining all of the background. Just one other headline for you. The England and Chelsea goalkeeper Hannah Hampton has this morning been named the BBC's Women's Footballer of the Year for 2025.
Thank you very much indeed. Let's look ahead to what's coming up on Radio 4.
A former dictator accused of crimes against humanity.
We cannot go in history having been those who abandoned the Spanish victims.
A race against time to apprehend a seemingly untouchable man.
He had filed a flight plan on a private jet to leave at 6:30 in the morning. The next morning, the next morning.
I'm lawyer and writer Philippe Sands, and I'll be retracing the remarkable five final days of a long legal battle to bring Augusto Pinochet to justice.
We need to do something.
The arrest. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
Quick look at the weather now. Today will be a dry and bright day for most. A cold day.
Very cold day. Yeah. Do stay tuned. After 8 o'clock this morning, you can hear our interview with the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Kaja Kallas. She is giving her reaction to the Ukraine-US draft deal, particularly the first part, which is very heavily weighted in favour of Russia. And it's fair to say that the EU's most senior foreign diplomat is not happy.
You just can't have a situation where, you know, you invade another country, you walk away with more than you have before, and there's no accountability, there's nothing. So, you know, this kind of activity just invites more aggression.
That coming up after 8 o'clock. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. It is now 26 minutes to 8 o'clock. And Charles Carroll has got a summary of the news.
A US official has confirmed to BBC News that talks with Russia are taking place in Abu Dhabi as part of diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine. The latest discussion comes after President Zelensky welcomed changes to America's plan for peace, which was originally criticised for being too favourable to Moscow. In the past few hours, President Macron of France has said that he doesn't want a peace that would be a capitulation of Ukraine. The Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, has once again come under heavy missile and drone attack. Officials say that six people have been killed and that two blocks of flats have been hit. Romania says that it scrambled fighter jets after two drones entered its airspace. Ukraine has also attacked Russia, with strikes reported in two southern regions. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has urged Labour MPs to back tomorrow's budget and has vowed to stay in post for years to come. In a defiant address to the parliamentary party, she said her measures would be progressive and she warned of difficult choices. She described the budget as a package, not a pick and mix. The communications watchdog Ofcom has urged technology companies to step up their efforts to tackle the trolling and online abuse of women. The regulators published guidance which includes measures such as prompts that ask users to reconsider before posting harmful content. Police forces are to prioritise trying to catch organised crime gangs that are targeting farms as part of a new crime strategy. The National Police Chiefs Council says that issues such as machinery theft strike at the heart of rural life. And a study has identified the rarest species in Wales based on the number of places they can be found. It's the first time such an approach has been used in the UK. According to the environmental body Natural Resources Wales, just under 3,000 species, from fungi to flies, exist in five locations or fewer.
Thank you, Charles. It's 24 minutes to 8 now. Let's talk a little more about those new guidelines from Ofcom for tech firms on how to better protect women and girls online. Will they do what they're supposed to do? They are not, crucially, a legal requirement, but those companies that choose to adopt them will be named, and therefore they might potentially find more women using their platforms as a result. Things like the ability to remove abusive comments as a single block rather than individually, or demonetising content that contains sexual violence are some of the elements that are laid out in this guidance. Here is Ofcom's chief, Melanie Dawes, talking about what social media companies can do.
It's about making reporting much easier so that you can report multiple accounts that are abusing you at the same time rather than having to do them one by one, which is absolutely soul-destroying. It's about putting all the privacy settings in one place, particularly for more vulnerable women, so that they can be confident that they're all turned on and they don't have to go through multiple different pages in the setup.
Well, it is a huge issue, so let's discuss it in a little more detail with Baroness Nikki Morgan, former Secretary of State for Education, former Minister for Women and Equalities, and Ava Santina, who's political correspondent at Politics Joe. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ava, you start us off because a lot of your job is existing where your readers, your audience are. So you are on social media. What is that world like for you?
Well, look, I mean, I think that it's not really important how it feels to me. I think it's important how it feels to the hundreds of thousands of young people up and down this country who are experiencing dramatic denigration of their mental health every single day because of algorithms used by these Silicon Valley social media outlets and tech companies that serve harmful content day after day. You know, we are seeing record numbers of 16 to 24-year-olds experiencing damaged mental health. We've got the highest number of young people unemployed. And I would lay that at the feet of the tech companies. And I think that's why this suggestion this morning from Ofcom feels so insulting. This idea that misogynistic content will reduce on social media platforms because there's a suggestion that men, or even actually some women hiding behind male personas, might want to reduce their antagonistic behaviour because of a prompt. Without legislation from the government, absolutely nothing is going to change, and you are going to see a continued dramatic rise in mental health with young people.
Baroness Morgan, what do you think? When you look at the guidelines, the fact that they are voluntary, some of the things that are contained in there, will they do the job that they're supposed to do?
Well, look, I understand the strength of feeling that Ava has just expressed. It's been a long battle to get here. And when the Online Safety Act, as a bill, was first put forward, it didn't even mention the plight of women and girls online. And we know they're 57% more likely to be abused, and Ava set out the challenges. So look, I welcome this from Ofcom. They have worked hard, they've listened. But look, it is disappointing. I mean, we pushed cross-party for there to be a statutory code of practice. We have ended up with this guidance. I think it is helpful. I think it gets some basic ground rules in place. But of course, it does depend on the attitude of the tech platforms in adopting the practical guidance put forward. Of course, some will, and you're right in your introduction, Anna, some will see this perhaps as a way of attracting more female users and contributors. And some just won't care and will carry on with the deeply harmful content that we see online today.
Just explain for me, Nikki, because people may well be listening to this and thinking, well, why isn't it written into law? Why has that been stepped away from?
Well, it was part of discussions back in 2022-23, and it has taken a long time, and Ofcom have worked very hard, but I think it's taken obviously a long time for what was in the eventual act to come through into guidance. I think their view was that there were already a number of statutory codes of practice. This is obviously a whole new area of regulation. And I do think the UK deserves credit, last government, this government, for pushing forward regulating these platforms. But I think the point is, of course, that the more statutory codes you have, the more they will obviously need to be enforced, whether that's fines or whether that is eventually in relation to actual action against directors and management. So I think it was a question perhaps of prioritising workload. Look, I personally think that Ofcom have said they're going to do a 2027 review of this code. Eventually, it will have to be statutory to really have teeth. But I think there are some useful things in there. You know, it's not the responsibility of the users so much anymore to report the content. You have to have the platforms designing right from the start their services to think about how they can be abused against or used to harm women and girls. You know, those are steps forward, but of course, it's just a starting point.
Do you think, Ava, there is a deep enough understanding of the abuse, the issues that women and girls are facing online? Do you think people get it?
I think that I don't want this to sound pejorative against Baroness Nikki, because of course this is not her responsibility, but I do think that in government, I think that age gap is really significant. And I do think when I'm speaking to MPs who sit on the Culture Select Committee, or I speak to people at DCMS, there is a real lack of understanding of what is actually happening online. You know, trying to explain that you've got features on Twitter, now known as X, called Grok, where you can create a misogynistic image or an abusive image of a woman in a matter of 3 seconds and post that onto the platform. You know, a lot of MPs are still talking about Photoshop. We are so far down the line and so far away from those sort of tools. The scale of abuse is off of the charts.
Do you think there's also a sort of a lack of perhaps understanding of how much, particularly for the younger generation, your online life is your life? It's not a question of going home at the end of the day, putting your phone down, picking it up again the next morning. You know, it's stuff that you can't get away from in the same way.
Yeah, there's absolutely no separation. And I think this is something that schools and colleges could address, because you should be having technology lessons rather than focusing on perhaps we should ban phones for under 16s. The conversation should be, how do you live alongside your phone? What is safe practice? And also forcing these tech companies to follow legislation. There should be no suggestion. It should be something you absolutely have to do. And particularly when you look at Elon Musk's Twitter, over the past year or so, he's actually removed tools that could have been helpful for young women. Why on earth would he be incentivized to bring them back now just because our regulator has suggested that he should?
Ava Santina, political correspondent at Politics Joe, and Baroness Morgan, thank you both for joining us.
It is now 17 minutes to 8. You know what they say, a dog is a man's best friend. Adam Cook has reason to believe that that is more than a sentimental cliche. His dog Polly, a 4-year-old golden retriever, is to be honoured tonight as a hero at the British Heart Foundation's Heart Hero Awards. Why? Well, because Polly helped to save Adam's life by alerting his wife, Hannah, that he was having a heart attack. Adam and Hannah Cook, join me now. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hannah, take us back to that night a few months ago. What happened?
Yeah, so March 2024, we went to bed as normal, and I was awoken at about 1 a.m. in the morning by Polly barking below us. So I realised that Adam wasn't breathing well, and I woke up and tried to get him to wake up himself, but then he completely stopped breathing. So I had to ring 999 and get Adam off the bed myself and start CPR then on the floor, all within seconds.
And if Polly hadn't barked, you might never have known.
No, well, with a cardiac arrest, you have seconds. So Polly probably knew before anybody else, and she woke us up.
Adam, you were in no doubt that Polly was barking because you were breathing oddly, rather than just because perhaps she'd heard something out the window.
Absolutely no doubt. She barks. If there's any noise at all downstairs, she'd be barking. She alerts you. And she, you know, I've no doubt that she was the one that alerted Hannah. And she, like, Hannah would turn to me and say, "Go down and see what that dog's barking about, would you?" And obviously that night when she turned to me and I didn't respond, she knew something wasn't right.
Mm. And she has a habit, doesn't she, of sort of looking after people when they're sick?
Yeah, she's very in tune with golden retrievers. Are like that. Anybody who has one will know how comforting they are. And she's very good at looking after us all.
Yeah. Adam, presumably you didn't know anything about this until days later.
That's right, yeah. I mean, obviously, they put me into an induced coma in the hospital. And then I woke up sort of 6 days later in the cardiac ward in the Southwest Acute Hospital near Enniskillen. Didn't know anything about it. I was sort of looking around me, why are all these wires coming out of me? And the nurses were brilliant, like, explaining just like what I've been through. And then obviously as time goes on, you sort of start to recognize people again and just remember your old life. But it takes time, you know. It took weeks and months to get back to normal.
And it was you, Adam, that put Polly up for the award, was it?
It was, yeah.
And Hannah, it's going to be quite a moment.
Yeah, no, we're really excited. It's all very surreal.
Now, we're not hearing barking at the moment. Where is Polly at the moment?
Oh, she's hopefully still sleeping, Polly.
she's at home.
She's at home in Enniskillen with my parents.
So she is happily asleep. And does she have any idea what's going on?
Oh, she knows.
I think she does know. Polly very much knows what's going on around us, and as long as she's part of us, that's all that matters.
She loves the attention.
Lovely. And when they arrived, Hannah, to take Adam to hospital, you probably had your mind on rather more important things. Did you at any stage though manage to say to them, it was the dog that did it, you should be giving the dog a hug?
No, not at that stage. It was afterwards, whenever the consultant asked me to go through the story. Then the first thing out of my mouth was Polly barked.
Yeah.
So that's when I knew. But I was very conscious that she'd been through such a difficult thing as well. Yeah. So we made sure she was looked after
and
too.
And a serious point, Hannah, it's because that change in breathing is a sign that someone's had a heart attack. That is the sound that Polly would have picked up.
It's very loud. I suppose if anybody's been through it, it's extremely loud. And maybe the human ear wouldn't hear it initially the way a dog's ear would. And I think that's what Polly would have heard.
Now, every dog owner, Adam, is wanting to know, what treat did Polly get for this amazing life-saving work?
She just loves our food more than anything else. So she gets our food, our treats. Uh-huh. Well, we try to avoid giving her chocolate because it's not good for her, but anything at all, like if we're having a bacon sandwich, she'd have that in her mouth before we would get it.
I say uh-huh, because normally you say don't spoil the dog, but in your case, you're going to carry on spoiling the dog forever, aren't you?
Of course.
Adam and Hannah. Well, delighted you're here to tell us the story, and congratulations to you, and of course, above all, to four-year-old golden retriever Polly, who sadly couldn't join us this morning.
But at least she's asleep, which is a reward all of its own, isn't it? It's 12 minutes to 8. Now it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is the Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James's Piccadilly. Good morning.
Good morning. I would have preferred a more ambitious agreement, the UK Energy Secretary commented to journalists after the final press release of the COP30 summit in Brazil didn't commit to an international reduction of fossil fuels. The G20 leaders are meeting too in Johannesburg, unusually issuing a statement at the beginning of their meeting, urging more global action on issues including climate-related disasters. The world is reorganising itself, declared the Chancellor of Germany, the third largest economy in the world. And in Geneva, international negotiations are continuing this week, provoked by the United States, to discuss the terms on which the war might end in Ukraine. In all of these international meetings, hugely consequential for people suffering the results of war or climate change, economic instability or political turbulence, the art of negotiation will be crucial. In Brazil, South Africa and Switzerland this week, judgment calls are being made all the time, assessing the relationship between compromise and appeasement, between realism and idealism, between certainty, however unpalatable, and the damaging exhaustion of permanent instability. And the statecraft of diplomacy and negotiation is a public service that often seems in the shadows. Pithy comments are made about the skill needed to get people around the table and keep them there, like that quotation often attributed to Winston Churchill, that the art of diplomacy is the ability to tell someone to go to hell in such a way that they look forward to the trip. The language of religion isn't often consonant with these accommodations and will more readily speak of the absolute principles of peace, justice, the common good, high ideals and noble ones. In the light of these absolutes, the trade-offs necessary in political negotiation can feel more like abandoning these ideals or at least weakening them. But in reality, these global negotiations go to the heart of human behaviour and desire, the exercise of power, and the ability of human beings to imagine together a different and better world. One of the lesser reported questions asked by Jesus concerned a builder who wanted to build a tower. Would you not, he asks, make calculations with regard to budget and process, this in order to avoid the ridicule of others if a half-built tower is all that's achieved? A Christian ethic will demand that we recognise our connection to, not our distance from, the sorts of consequential negotiations that can feel as if they're happening above our heads. We are leaders in our own lives, mediators at our own tables. All of us have a voice in the negotiations of living, and making a contribution to this sort of peacemaking is never as far away as we think.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James's Piccadilly. It is 9 minutes to eight now.
Taxes going up again. That looks certain to be the headline story of tomorrow's budget. Equally certain, though, is the criticism that will come from the Chancellor's opponents that those tax rises are only necessary because Rachel Reeves has not just failed to cut welfare spending, she's planning to increase it by scrapping the two-child benefit cap. Let's just explore that a little in a moment with the President of the Resolution Foundation, Lord Willetts. First with our Verify correspondent, Ben Chu. Morning to you, Ben. Just take us through some numbers, if you would. How much is the increase in welfare spending projected to be by the end of this Parliament?
Morning, Nick. Well, obviously, total government welfare spending is north of £300 billion a year. But the really fast-growing bit and the bit that politicians want to get down is the working-age health and disability spending budget. And this year we're spending about £61 billion on that. By the end of the decade, 2030, it's projected to go up to about £72 billion. So it'll be just under £5 in every £100 of total government spending by then. So in the in March, the government tried to get that bill down by curbing access to personal independence payments and the incapacity benefit. And that would have reduced that £72 billion figure by 2030 by about £5 billion. So it would have stopped it growing by that amount effectively.
And it's now, not, obviously, that it's not the only U-turn, is it? We've had a U-turn on welfare reform, on means testing winter fuel payments, on, and now it looks inevitable on scrapping the two-child benefit cap. Can we put a sort of number on how much that's going to add to the bill?
We can. So obviously the £5 billion from the U-turn initially, then another £1.25 billion roughly on the winter fuel payments U-turn. The cost of scrapping the two-child benefit cap limit is estimated to be about £3.6 billion. So you put all that together and you've got a roughly £10 billion gap that Rachel Reeves will have to try to fill in the budget tomorrow.
Ben Chu, thank you very much indeed. Let's turn then to David Willetts. Lord Willetts, morning to you.
Morning, Nick. Hi.
Now, you're a Conservative peer, but you are also president of the think tank, which is said to have virtually written this budget because your old director is now a Treasury Minister. We used to hear him a lot on the programme, didn't we? And is supposed indeed to have done it. Do you believe the central criticism of your old colleagues in the Conservative Party, too much welfare is leading to too much taxes, is a fair one?
Well, if you look at what's happening, there's been very strong growth in pension spending since the COVID epidemic, and it's growing rapidly. And there's very rapid growth in disability benefit spending. And both of those can, over time, be reined back. And you can do things to rein back the growth of disability benefits, things like more frequent assessments of people on disability benefits, perhaps raising the bar for some of the mental health claims. And you should also rein back the growth of pensioner benefits because the triple lock is very expensive. But what we've pointed out at Resolution Foundation is that the one area of benefit spending which is not growing, has actually really been heavily cut, is for working age families. And that's where poverty is getting worse and the most severe cuts have fallen. So it's right to rebalance our social security spending, have a fairer deal for working age families and try to make some savings on the growth areas, which are pensions and disability benefits.
Now, when you talk of a fairer deal, that means that you, though a Conservative peer, are in favour, I think, at the Resolution Foundation of lifting this two-child benefit cap. In other words, meaning that families with more children will get more benefit in future. What do you say to the likes of Sir Jeremy Hunt, who was on the programme recently on our Today debate, pointing out that when the Institute for Fiscal Studies looked at this, they found that it made no difference long-term to the life chances of people?
Well, it clearly does have an immediate and direct effect on child poverty. And we should remember, first of all, about half of the families that will be helped are working families. And for most of them, these are families who have a third child and their circumstances may well have changed since they had their children. But look, what we've shown overall at Resolution Foundation is that since 2010, the benefits for working age families have been cut by about £1,500 each, and benefits for pensioners have gone up by about £800 on top of the basic benefits and on top of basic policy.
But that trend's going to go on, isn't it, David, in the sense of there's no sign that the government wants to curb pensioner benefits, and indeed the triple lock, the effect of the triple lock introduced by the Conservatives, is they're going to keep soaring.
Well, no, I think actually there's a wider lesson for politics here. I think people exaggerate what governments can do in the short run and underestimate what governments can do in the long run. And my view is it's absolutely doable to say we should control the total of benefit spending and within that rebalance it. I don't think that the triple lock should be carried on after the next election. I also think actually you could speed up increases in the pension age. I do think we can do things to bring down the growth of disability benefits. And that in turn should liberate resources for the people who've clearly had the worst deal, the working age families.
We haven't long, I'm afraid, David, but just spell that out a little more, would you? Are you saying that short-term cuts, a few billion here or there, are actually much more painful than rather dramatic changes, providing you phase them in over a long time?
Indeed, because often you say these only apply to new claimants. And when it comes to, for example, more frequent reassessments of people on disability benefits, and sometimes the delays on getting that reassessments are enormous, those type of measures do help you get a grip on the programme of spending in the long run. And meanwhile, if the markets can see that you have a credible long-term plan for getting a grip on that, you may find that does bring savings by lower interest rates in the short run. But it has to be a credible long-term plan. The trouble with this government is they try to rush out the winter fuel payment cut and then the further 5 billion in such a hurry without any preparation and without working through how you could implement it month by month, year by year.
Lord Willetts at the Resolution Foundation, thank you very much.
Continuing this afternoon, there's a look at some defining British objects and emblems.
I'm David Cannadine, and in a new series for Radio 4, I'm exploring the objects and emblems that embody the British Constitution.
There is no greater symbol of national unity than our Union Jack.
In each episode, I'll be uncovering the stories behind these different materials of state and asking how they speak to the past, present and future of British political history.
They're always going to be sources of discussion, debate and disagreement.
Materials of State continues this afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's catch up with the weather news. Here's Helen. Morning, Helen.
Good morning, Nick. Hello there. Ridge of high pressure is building in across the UK today, which means it'll cut off the feed for the showers. So we do have a number of showers around this morning as we start in England and Wales, both in the west, running through Pembrokeshire and Cornwall, and in the east, particularly eastern coastal counties, just isolated really East Anglia in the southeast. Still quite a keen north breeze though blowing here, so it will blow a few more in today and then eventually they'll fade. So plenty of sunshine elsewhere. After the cold and locally frosty start, we'll see temperatures rising to between 6 and 9 degrees Celsius, tempered a little again in eastern England today. There's a keen north wind. It's not as strong as it was yesterday. Now, Northern Ireland will also see the shower activity diminish. There are very few around anyway. Plenty of sunshine today. And after that cold, frosty, even icy start, temperatures up to, 7 to 9 degrees Celsius. And for Scotland as well, the showers even are few and far between, mostly around coastal counties, inland, plenty of sunshine. But oh, it's cold this morning, so watch out for a little bit of ice. Temperatures up to 7 later.
Thank you very much, Helen. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Tuesday the 25th of November. The headlines this morning, talks are to take place between US and Russian officials in Abu Dhabi as part of diplomatic efforts to try and end the war in Ukraine. We'll be speaking to the EU's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, who gives her reaction to the draft framework.
You just can't have a situation where, you know, you invade another country, you walk away with more than you have before, and there's no accountability, there's nothing. So, you know, this kind of activity just invites more aggression.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has urged Labour MPs to unite behind her budget while warning them they might not like every measure in it. And Ofcom has issued new guidance intended to curb what it calls the significant and widespread abuse of women online.
And coming up in the next hour, we've got exclusive access to a women's prison, hearing from inmates about life on the inside.
You leave prison with more issues than you had coming in. The trauma of actually being in this environment and the things that you see and the things that you hear, I think that is another reason why the reoffending rate is so high.
And? What a viral TikTok dance reveals about the changing way we consume sport. That's all after the BBC News read for us this morning by Charles Carroll.
A US official has told BBC News that an American delegation is to meet Russian representatives in Abu Dhabi to discuss proposals to end the war in Ukraine. The talks are the latest attempt by the Trump administration to bridge the gaps between Russia and Ukraine. President Macron of France has said this morning that he wants peace, but not a peace that would be the capitulation of Ukraine. On the ground, drone and missile attacks have killed at least six people in Kyiv. Our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, is there and sent this report.
It was another night of heavy Russian strikes, including in the capital, Kyiv. Proof there is no diplomatic breakthrough and no end to the war in sight. But after the talks in Geneva, Ukraine appears to have a peace plan it can work with. It's significantly different from the version presented by the US last week, which included many Russian demands, such as Ukraine giving up more of its territory. President Zelensky said the new draft had many of the right elements. Europe, too, is working to strengthen his position, with Sir Keir Starmer today hosting a virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing. But that's all likely to mean it's less acceptable to Moscow. US officials are meeting Russian representatives today in Abu Dhabi.
Russia says that Ukrainian drone attacks have killed three people and wounded 10 more in the Rostov region on the border between the two countries. In an interview with this programme, the European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaya Kallas, has said that any final peace agreement could not be made up of just Russian demands.
You know, if we want to end this for good, we really, really need to have concessions on Russian side. Because if you look at those points, I mean, the points shouldn't be, how to make it easier for Russia to invade again, to downsize Ukrainian army and all these points, but actually how to make it impossible for Russia to invade again.
Rachel Reeves has delivered a defiant message to Labour MPs ahead of her budget tomorrow, telling them that she will be Chancellor for years to come and that they must stick together if they want to win the next election. She promised them a Labour budget that was progressive, but she also warned of tough choices. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Politics is a team sport, Rachel Reeves told restive Labour MPs last night. The need for that reminder is a sign of just how fraught some of the build-up to this budget has been. With growing questions about Labour's leadership, the Chancellor told the party it must stick together in order to win the next election and promised she would still be in the job next year and the year after. But Ms Reeves warned of difficult choices in tomorrow's budget and told MPs they might not like every measure she announces. It's a package, not a pick and mix, she said. There were hints of more money for the NHS and measures to curb inflation. Rachel was strong and honest, one convinced MP said afterwards. Others were not so sure and said her pleas for unity sounded desperate.
Tech firms are being urged to adopt new guidelines aimed at protecting women and girls in the UK from abuse online. The regulator Ofcom says the measures go above and beyond what's needed to comply with the law. It says women should not have to think twice before expressing themselves online, nor face relentless trolling for simply doing their jobs. Here's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Ofcom's new guidelines are not a legal requirement, but the regulator says it'll publicly name the tech companies which choose to adopt them. They're practical and include recommendations such as enabling the multiple blocking of abusive comments in one go rather than having to go through them all individually, demonetising content that contains sexual violence, and nudging social media users whose posts are flagged as abusive or misogynistic before they're published. But the watchdog has already faced criticism that it lacks teeth. So far, it's issued just two fines for non-compliance with the Online Safety Act. One of them was given to the platform 4chan, which has refused to pay it.
Richard Ratcliffe, whose wife, Nazanin, was detained in Iran for 6 years, has called on the government to do more to bring home a British couple who are being held in the country. Craig and Lindsay Foreman were arrested by the Iranian authorities while on a motorbike journey from Europe to Australia. They were accused of espionage but haven't been convicted. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Caroline Hawley.
It's almost 11 months since Lindsay and Craig Foreman's trip of a lifetime turned into what their son has called an enduring nightmare. The couple are being held in separate crowded cells in Evin Jail, where Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was imprisoned. Their son Joe says they're innocent and are being held for political reasons, in conditions he's described as horrific. He's urged the government to communicate transparently with the family about its strategy to get them home. Richard Ratcliffe, Nazanin's husband, told the BBC that he didn't want to see another family separated for years and said the government needed a new policy to deal with state hostage-taking. The Foreign Office says it continues to raise the case with the Iranian authorities.
The prisons minister, James Timpson, has told BBC News that there are too many women in prisons who shouldn't be there because they are victims of domestic violence. Instead, he says they should be in safe places, preferably with their children. New laws expected next year are likely to see fewer custodial sentences for women. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
There are more than 3,000 women in prison in England, just 4% of the prison population. The government says women who commit serious offences should be inside, but not those convicted of lesser offences. More than half of female inmates report being victims of domestic abuse. The prisons minister, Lord Timpson, says many women shouldn't be in jail.
I've met far too many women in prison who are there. They are black and blue. They've been beaten up by their partners. And I don't believe prison is the right place for them.
But these women are criminals and some will have little sympathy. The Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, says it will often be more appropriate to hand down alternative punishments to pregnant women and victims of domestic abuse.
An Australian senator has been suspended for 7 sitting days after she wore a burqa in Parliament as part of her long-running campaign for a ban on the garment. Pauline Hanson, who leads the anti-immigration One Nation party, did the same thing in 2017. Repeating the stunt has been condemned by fellow senators, with one accusing her of blatant racism. A study has identified the rarest species in Wales based on the number of places where they can be found. It's the first time such an approach has been used in the UK. According to the environmental regulator Natural Resources Wales, there are just under 3,000 species from fungi to flies that exist in 5 locations or fewer. Of these, 1,200 are found at only one site. Here's our Wales correspondent, Howell Griffith. From the Snowdon lily that grows only in the Eryri mountain range to the glutinous snail that can only be found slithering along the shores of Llyn Tegid Lake, the report lists the different rare species it says are in peril. Some, such as the Arctic Alpine pea mussel, are in danger of extinction. Others, such as the bitheye beast millipede, are relatively recent discoveries. All, according to Natural Resources Wales, need to be protected by reversing the decline in biodiversity. The environmental watchdog says this can be done cost-effectively with simple measures such as trimming vegetation to open up space and saving older, veteran trees from being cut down. A golden retriever from County Fermanagh will be honoured today as one of the British Heart Foundation's CPR heroes for helping to save the life of one of her owners. A bark from 4-year-old Polly woke Adam Cook's wife, Hannah, who was then able to perform emergency resuscitation on him until an ambulance arrived at their home in Enniskillen last year. The couple told us that they would be forever grateful to Polly.
I was awoken at about 1 a.m. in the morning by Polly barking below us. So I realised that Adam wasn't breathing well, and I woke up and tried to get him to wake up himself, but then he completely stopped breathing. So I had to ring 999 and get Adam off the bed myself and start CPR then.
I've no doubt that she was the one that alerted Hannah. And Hannah would turn to me and say, "Go down and see what that dog's barking about, would you?" And obviously that night when she turned to me and I didn't respond, she knew something wasn't right.
Polly's owner, Adam Cook.
Thank you, Charles. It is 10 minutes past 8. That's the sound of Kyiv's skies last night as Russia once again rained missiles on the city, killing at least six people. Russia's defence ministry says it's intercepted and destroyed 249 Ukrainian drones in its own airspace, which is one of the highest figures reported. Successful talks on a peace deal between the two would need to contain concessions from both sides, and the final agreement should make it impossible for Russia to invade Ukraine again in the future. That is what the EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, has told this programme as negotiations continue on the latest US-backed proposal to end the fighting. She says that the first leaked draft of the plan, which strongly reflects Russian demands and contains plans to bring it back into the international diplomatic fold, puts the blame on the victim and says the concessions in that version of the proposal need to come from Moscow, not Kyiv. 2 days of talks have seen the original documents moderated to be more reflective of what Ukraine wants. But of course, the trade-off then is that Russia, having made positive noises about the first draft, may now choose to reject the modified version if it moves too far away from what it wants. Well, the Russian state news agency RIA Novosti has reported in the last few minutes that the Kremlin has not yet received the adjusted US plan for Ukraine. And just a few moments ago, NATO confirms that its Secretary General Mark Rutte will be involved in the virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, co-hosted by Emmanuel Macron and Sir Keir Starmer, which will happen this afternoon. Well, I spoke yesterday to Kaja Kallas, yesterday afternoon. She is the Vice President of the European Commission. We talked after a meeting yesterday morning between key EU figures about the wording of that document and what it should look like when the final one is agreed upon. And I asked her if this latest version of the US proposed ceasefire plan, the one which started to make the rounds at the end of last week, had had EU involvement at any point in its preparation.
These have been the maximalist plans of Russia. So, of course, we have heard these points before. I think we need to shift the discussion from putting the blame on the victim to actually talking about the concessions that Russia should make. Because if we have a plan that is concentrating how we can make sure that they will not go any further, they will stop the killing and they will not invade again, then we should really focus on the concessions that the Russians are going to make.
It's interesting hearing you describe the maximalist demands of Russia, because there has been debate and discussion about whether or not Russia actually had a hand in putting this together. Do you think they did?
Well, the journalists have done a good job in this, and we have heard from different sources also in America that this is the basis. And therefore, I think we should really go back to the table and draft the concessions that Russia should make, that they honor the obligations that they have taken under various international agreements, that they also take obligations to downsize their military budget, because that will give them again, you know, reasons to invade and attack their neighbors. I think this is important conversations that we should be having if we really want to focus on this not happening again and really stopping for good.
There are some real potential wins for Russia in there, certainly in terms of having all sanctions lifted and particularly in terms of being allowed to rejoin the G7 and make it the G8 once again. Is that something that you think should be allowed to happen?
No, definitely not. We can't go back to business as usual. I mean, how can you possibly imagine that? All the destruction, all the killing that they have done, and also, I mean, all the breaches of the international law, and then we just look away and say, oh, it's nothing. We just go and continue as before. I think it is important to keep in mind why, you know, Russia is making a good face towards United States again, because they are actually under a lot of pressure. They want us to see that and think that, you know, Ukraine is under a lot of pressure and they can't outlast. But actually, if you look at the facts, if you look how Russia's economy is doing, if you look how the sanctions on oil are working, if you look at the discussions that we have on the Russian frozen assets and the reparations loan, actually, they are very worried that, you know, they need to get the good agreement now. That's why they are asking for the territories that they haven't even conquered militarily. That's why they are asking all these things. Our focus should be on Russia, who is the aggressor in this case.
Why do you think the US, and in particular Donald Trump, are doing this now? Do you think he, even after all of this time, understands the Ukrainian position?
No, President Trump genuinely wants peace, like also the Ukrainians and Europeans. I mean, you can't blame him for that. I think this is a very, very noble cause. The question is what really brings peace and what brings a long-lasting and sustainable peace that we don't have, you know, future aggression.
Do you think it's peace at any cost? Is that what he's pursuing?
Well, he definitely wants to have peace and wants to have it soon. This is true, and also Ukrainians want to have peace because their people are being killed and their energy infrastructure is being bombed. But you know, if we want to end this for good, we really, really need to have concessions on Russian side, because if you look at those points, I mean, the points shouldn't be how to make it easier for Russia to invade again, to downsize Ukrainian army and all these points, but actually how to make it impossible for Russia to invade again. And that means, you know, honoring their international obligations, downsizing their nuclear, their army, their military budget. All these things are the concessions that we need to see from the Russian side.
Do you think that European leaders are speaking out clearly enough about this? Because listening to what you're saying here, I would say that you are making a far stronger point than any of them have made in the last few days. Do they need to say and do more?
Well, we just had the leaders meeting today, and everybody's really, you know, praising the efforts to achieve peace. But we also need to understand how to achieve this peace. You just can't have a situation where, you know, you invade another country, you walk away with more than you have before, and there's no accountability, there's nothing. So, you know, this kind of activity just invites more aggression.
But European leaders are looking peripheral in this, because this US plan, which is on the table, which is being discussed, was put together without them. They're being sidelined.
For any plan to really succeed, you need the Europeans and you need the Ukrainians to agree with this, because this war is going on the European soil. It has effects on the European security, and it has effects also long term. And that's why we need to be very clear. Our line has been very clear. We will continue supporting Ukraine and also putting pressure on Russia by new sanctions.
President Trump has spoken out again against President Zelensky. He's accused him again of not showing gratitude for US efforts to end the war. Who is best placed at this stage to stand up to Donald Trump on this?
Well, again, what I said before, I think, you know, President Trump genuinely wants peace. You know, just today I asked a list for, you know, about all the countries that Russia has invaded, and I got, you know, only 20th century and 21st century, 33 cases where they have invaded somebody. Very often the same countries, but still none of those countries has ever invaded Russia. So this is what we have to understand, that we really need to have a firm approach so that, you know, Russia does not continue. So yes, let's have a ceasefire so that we can actually sit down and negotiate. And negotiations means that both parties have obligations, although here both parties are not equal, because one is the victim and the other one is aggression.
Do you feel that now is a moment that Vladimir Putin is ready for peace? Because nobody seems to have the leverage with him at the moment, not European leaders, not even President Trump. Does this feel like a different moment or more of the same?
I think they are in a difficult position. At least they will be by the end of this year. They want us to believe, you know, they can continue forever. This is not true. Their revenues from oil have dropped significantly due to the sanctions on Shadow Fleet and also the U.S. sanctions. They don't have, they can't raise capital outside because of the sanctions. Their national fund is almost completely depleted. 25% of Russian companies are in the threat of bankruptcy. Their economic situation is extremely bad. So they soon should run out of money to fund this war. And that would be the breaking point.
As a final thought, when I was last in Ukraine in April of this year, I sat down with the mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, and he said that He believed temporarily, at some point, Ukraine would be forced to cede land in return for peace. Now, that was not well received in the Ukrainian parliament. There was a great deal of frustration. He was the first senior Ukrainian parliamentarian to say that. Do you believe that that's the case, that at some point Ukraine will have to give away its land if this war is to end?
If there's a ceasefire and the freeze of the battlegrounds that nobody moves, then it doesn't mean that Ukraine has a control over those occupied territories. But if we don't recognize those territories to be Russian, then it also matters a great deal.
Kaya Kallas, Vice President of the European Commission and the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. Thank you for joining us.
It is now 21 minutes past eight. The chairman of the BBC was asked by MPs yesterday whether he'd considered resigning, having presided over the resignation of both the BBC's Director General and the Chief Executive of BBC News. Sam Ayersha insisted it was his job to steady the ship and, above all, to find a replacement for Tim Davey, who's been Director General of the BBC for the past 5 years. Now, what did the MPs make of the evidence they heard, not just from Dr. Shah, but the others who were giving evidence on behalf of the BBC, or indeed the author of that memo, Michael Prescott, that got into the Daily Telegraph and blew apart arguments that were going on behind the scenes about editorial standards? Well, we'll get the considered verdict of the committee when they publish their report. But last night on The World Tonight, the chair of the Select Committee, Dame Caroline Dynage, was asked if she thought Samir Shah was the person to lead the BBC out of its problems.
The BBC can't be left without a DG and without a chair. Someone needs to be there to kind of lead the march to replace the leadership. But, you know, equally, I don't think as a committee we were wildly enthused that the board is in safe hands.
Listening to that and watching for many hours yesterday, our culture and media editor, Katie Razzle, sounds as if that report may not be desperately helpful to the board and indeed to the chairman, Katie.
Well, Nick, you've got to remember, this committee has never expressed a great deal of confidence in Samir Shah. I mean, when he was first being appointed by the government back in 2022, early 2024, after the resignation of the previous chairman, Richard Sharp, the Culture, Media and Sport Committee held a session with him and effectively said it didn't think he was up to it and they wanted him to come back and prove to them that he was. They're a part of the appointments process of the BBC chairman. They have to give their seal of approval. But I think it's fair to say they never went full throttle with their support. So, yes, yesterday, you know, Caroline Daniel, based on what she said afterwards, you know, clearly wasn't impressed. But I mean, I think if we're talking about people not being impressed, I came on your programme yesterday and I said the committee hearing had the potential to be box office but could be a letdown. And I do think it was more the latter. They really didn't land any killer blows. And I think the BBC board members, especially Samir Shah, went in looking nervous, gained confidence as it went along and came out really knowing that they had presented unity and they hadn't fallen into any traps. And my assessment was that Samir Shah was in a weak position when he went in. You know, he's under pressure after all the resignations, the revelations, the threat from Donald Trump. And as one committee member put it to me afterwards, he didn't come out any weaker. Well, I think he actually came out a little bit stronger than when he went in. He certainly lives to fight another day, but of course he's still damaged. And Caroline Dynage is making her feelings known. She's essentially saying they've lost two top people, the Director General and the head of news. They can't lose another, but if it wasn't for that, we would potentially be thinking perhaps they should have a different chairman. That's essentially what she's saying. To be clear,
though, the Select Committee get an opinion, an important opinion. You could even call it a distinguished opinion, but it is just that. They have nothing to do with who's the next chairman of the BBC or indeed whether the existing one should go or stay.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, they have something to do with it in the sense that they're part of the appointments process. So, as I was saying, so if there was to be a new chairman, they would be a part of kind of vetting that person and nodding them through. But you're right, they don't have any part to play, but they will write a report. We'll see what they say. I mean, I think there's a lot that did come out of that committee hearing that in a way is still sort of left hanging, because, for example, on the points that were being made by the original, you know, Michael Prescott in his memo, and then he gave this long evidence yesterday, which was actually very, you know, of course, very interesting in lots of ways. But he said he didn't think the BBC was institutionally biased, but there were systemic issues in the way it works. And I never really understood through his evidence and through the questioning exactly what he meant. And so that's still hanging over it. Then you had the other external advisor, former external advisor, also an ex-journalist like him, also in corporate affairs, someone called Caroline Daniel, who said completely the opposite and said she thought the BBC was very quick to respond. Then we had Samir Shah saying he didn't know why it takes so long for the BBC to admit mistakes, but he's going to look into it. And yet there he was as the chair of this committee where, you know, this issue about the Panorama was raised a couple of times and nothing happened until it emerged in the Daily Telegraph many months later. So there's still lots of questions around exactly what happened. And I will be interested in looking at their report, even if I was a little bit disappointed in the more than 3 hours I spent watching that.
I watched for the full 3 hours as well. And it seems to me, Katie, that in the end, the question is not merely about personnel, not merely about process, not merely about speed. But the critics of the BBC, Mr. Prescott himself, writing that memo, echoed in the Daily Telegraph editorial today, and it was the paper that got the leak and got this story going, is essentially the BBC is failing to recognise a cultural problem in the way it recruits people, trains people and covers stories. That seemed to me the central critique that came through that hearing.
Yes, that was the central critique, but I'm not sure whether we got enough evidence for it, did we? I mean, I don't know what you thought, Nick, but I listened and watched. And because you had, as I said, two people sitting next to each other who disagreed and had been in all the same meetings and read all the same reports, and yet one of them was saying exactly as you say it and the other one wasn't, I wasn't entirely clear that point was landed. And then we had three board members who all said the same thing, which is, you know, we're unified. What everybody essentially said was, we care so much about the BBC. It's the most important. I mean, that was Michael Prescott's, you know, one of his very, key points, I think, was he was saying, I love the BBC. I think the BBC in this time of, you know, disaffection and polarisation has the potential to be not just the most trusted in Britain, but the most trusted source of news across the world. And that's why I wrote the memo, because I want it to be better. Mm. And yet, you know, after all those hours, did we quite understand why or how? Yes, maybe reading the Telegraph, we get more of a sense of it. But I'm not sure we got that much of a sense of it in the committee. And of course, Michael Prescott was accused by some of the MPs of only, you know, highlighting what they called, what one of them called, culture war issues. You know, Rupert Huxley was saying, why do you only raise things that come from a sort of, you know, you're saying there's left wing bias as opposed to the opposite. You know, I just didn't think in the end we learnt as much as we were hoping, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Yeah, you're sounding rather like a Strictly judge. I think, what do we think? You gave him about a 4 by the sounds of it there, Katie. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Katie Russell, culture and media editor. You will note that I am carefully avoiding your invitation to express my judgment on this. Let's turn instead to cheery news about what happened at Old Trafford last night, Garthy.
You've been waiting for this all morning, haven't you, Nick? The scoreline may have only been 1-0 as Everton beat Manchester United last night in the Premier League, but it was an incredibly eventful match. Everton went down to 10 men after just 13 minutes when Idrissa Gueye was sent off for striking his own teammate, Michael Keane. Now, the Champions League takes centre stage tonight with Chelsea hosting Barcelona, and we can speak to the former Chelsea forward. I rarely use the word legend, but I think it applies. Morning, Gianfranco Zola.
Good morning.
It's lovely to have you with us, part of the Prime Video team for tonight's game. And managers, they do always say it's just game by game. That's exactly what the Chelsea manager Enzo Maresca said. But how important is this for both sides?
No, obviously, it's a big game, not only for the points, but also because, you know, winning a game like tonight's game will be very prestigious. I think it will give a lot of energies and morale to both sides. So I think, you know, the points are important, but there is more in at stake.
Barcelona are the club that inspired Maresca to go into management when Pep Guardiola was there. How successful do you think Maresca has been with getting, you know, what's known as the tiki-taka style out of his players at Chelsea?
Well, results-wise, so far it's been excellent, I have to say. Maresca, you know, not only got the team playing very good football, but also he's got the team balanced, strong, and winning. So I have to say that he is I'm impressed with his work. I saw his team, previous team, Leicester, playing, and I like. And I was curious to see what they could do the same at Chelsea. He looks like he's succeeding in this. And so I think it's going very, very well in the right direction.
They are going in the right direction, but as are Barcelona, they're top of La Liga. How do you think that could affect Chelsea's mentality tonight going into this game?
No, I think that won't be a problem. I think everybody at Chelsea knows the importance of the game, the value of the opposition team, and they will be fired up. I think, you know, the Chelsea is a young team. They wanna play well. They wanna win against Barcelona. I mean, it's everybody would love to win against Barcelona, and I think Chelsea has got the possibility to do because they are in a good moment.
Yeah, you mentioned young players. Each side has a very special 18-year-old, Estevao for Chelsea, Lamine Yamal for Barcelona. It's just a great opportunity to see them both on the same pitch, isn't it? Which doesn't often happen with these kinds of special talents.
Yeah, we don't know whether Estevao will play or not. That is one of the curiosities for today. Yeah, I think it will be very exciting to see players like them. I think when in a football team you are a player like Yamal or Estevao, you know, you go to the pitch with a lot of, you go to the stadium and you are excited already because those players, they can produce great displays. And football is also about this, and looking forward. I mean, Estevao is on the way, on the right track. I think he can become a very important player. You can see, glimpses of pure class. On the other side, Yamal is a player that we can consider an established player despite the young age. And to be honest, I saw him last year in the games against Inter, and he was impressive.
Yeah, very, very impressive. And just finally, can I ask you something away from football, if you don't mind? Lovely to see you as part of the Europe Ryder Cup team as an official buggy driver. You were passing on your experience on handling pressure and hostile crowds, but what did you learn from that experience?
Hello?
Oh, hello, Gianfranco, can you still hear me? I was just asking you about being part of the Europe Ryder Cup team as the official buggy driver. Did you learn a lot from that experience, or were you handing over your experience on handling pressure to the team? Oh, I think we may have lost Gianfranco Zola. What a shame. Well, he is part of Prime Video's coverage of Chelsea versus Barcelona from 6:30 with kickoff at 8 p.m. I'll ask him about that another time because I really want to know. There's also commentary of that game on 5 Live and on Sports Extra. There's commentary of Manchester City hosting Bayer Leverkusen. And Newcastle United are away at Marseille tonight too.
I wanted to ask him whether slapping one of your teammates in the face should get you sent off, which is what happened in that Everton game.
Yes. We were discussing whether to ask him about whether he'd ever been hit by a teammate. That's the most bizarre part of it, isn't it? It
was very, very rare. I think the last sending off was against somebody.
There's an interesting list on the BBC Sport website.
Ah,
have a look at that.
That's your post-programme reading sorted for today then, isn't it?
Hitting a colleague, not advisable. A red card offence, just to be clear.
Yeah, bit of good advice for you now, starting this morning at 9.
I've always believed that history is not just about what happened in the past. History is also about what we can and should do today.
Please welcome the BBC's 2025 Reith Lecturer, Rutger Bregman.
The historian Rutger Bregman calls for a moral revolution.
That is the goal of this lecture series, to argue that the most urgent transformation of our time is not technological or geopolitical or industrial, but moral.
The Reith Lectures on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Thank you.
Begins this morning at 9.
The weather today will be dry and bright for most of us. It will be cold, though. So if you're at that point where you're considering the scarf, the extra layer, the gloves, the answer is yes. Do it. You'll be glad you did.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Too late, though. I needed you at 3:30.
Too late for us, yeah.
It's coming up to 25 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. And Charles Carroll's now got a summary of the news.
A US official has confirmed to BBC News that talks with Russia are to take place in Abu Dhabi as part of diplomatic efforts to end the war in Ukraine. The latest discussions come after the Ukrainian president welcomed changes to America's plan for peace, European leaders had raised concerns about the original version. Russian state media says the Kremlin hasn't received the adjusted proposals. Ukraine has called Russia's latest overnight bombardment a terrorist response to the US peace framework. Officials in Kyiv say 22 missiles and 460 drones were launched, killing at least six people. The governor of Russia's Rostov region said that Ukrainian drone attacks had killed three people. Rachel Reeves has urged Labour's MPs to unite behind her forthcoming budget and has insisted that she will be Chancellor for years to come. She told a meeting of the parliamentary party that the measures announced tomorrow would be progressive, but also warned of difficult choices. And Ofcom has urged technology companies to step up their efforts to tackle the trolling and online abuse of women. The regulator has published new voluntary guidance, which includes measures such as prompts that ask users to reconsider before posting harmful content.
Thank you, Charles. It's now 24 minutes to nine. Children and young people who are questioning their gender deserve safe, compassionate and effective care, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting said when he announced a medical trial of puberty-blocking drugs last week. But this morning, one of the whistleblowers, whose evidence helped to bring about the closure of GIDS, the controversial Gender Identity Development Service at the Tavistock Clinic, is warning that that trial will harm children and leave them with consequences they'll bear for life. We'll hear from her in just a moment. But first, here's the woman who's running the trial. On Saturday's programme, Professor Emily Siminoff, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at King's College London, told us that her study had gone through rigorous examination.
Of course, this study has gone through all the usual approvals and regulatory scrutiny, which involved the Human Research Authority and the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, sometimes known as the MHRA. And there, the UK has very high levels of scrutiny of clinical trials to make sure that first they're properly conducted, but also in terms of how we think about the wide range of measures. We're looking at young people's psychological state, emotional well-being, physical health and quality of life, as well as any possible adverse effects here.
Well, that doesn't reassure Susan Evans, who was a mental health nurse and psychotherapist at that controversial Tavistock Gender Identity Development Service, which was closed after long arguments about whether it was helping or desperately harming young people. Susan Evans joins us this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. Thanks for inviting me on.
Your concerns are listed in seven detailed, closely typed pages to the Health Secretary. So before we get into any detail, for the people who haven't really followed this argument, don't quite understand the passions that it stirs, and it really does, what is your central fear?
So children are on a developmental pathway, and through adolescence, there are all sorts of psychological and physical tasks for the young person. And it's a struggle. And I think this particular generation of children are having additional struggles because they're subject to a very different sort of social and cultural milieu and the internet and so on. But having said that, these are well-recognized sort of developmental tasks. You're moving from childhood, your body is developing, your mind is developing, and you are going to find your place in the world as an adult. And the problem with blocking puberty with a child who is struggling or distressed about their identity is that you interfere with a very normal, natural process. And it's a required process for that developmental task.
Now, what Hilary Cass says, Cass, of course, did the review that closed that clinic that you came to believe was harming children. She says, and I quote, because we asked her for an up-to-date statement on this, there are clinicians, there are children and families who believe passionately in the beneficial effects of these drugs. And given that there's been an overall ban, that's me paraphrasing then, she then goes on to say, and I quote, a trial is the only way forward to make sense of this. Are you arguing that there should be no puberty-blocking drugs, no trial of them at all?
So we had a trial, and that was at the JIDS Tavistock that I raised the concerns about. And I would say, in answer to the clip you just played, the issue there was that the Health Research Authority were meant to have strong oversight of that project, and that went on for years. And JIDS even increased the age range of those children, right down to sort of a 10-year-old at Tanner Stage 2. And no one really asked them, please report on your work so far. So there were hundreds of children going through a research program. It was extended, and this so-called, National Health Research Authority didn't ask or persist with asking for their results, and they did not actually print any results and make them public until we took them to the Kirribell.
Let me see if I've got this clear. Are you saying that you simply don't trust the authorities that are overseeing this, the HRA and the MHRA, or are you saying, look, just in principle, I'm against ever trialling these puberty-blocking drugs because I think blocking puberty harms children irreparably? Which is it?
It's both, Nick, because if you look at the history of the last 10 years or so, and it was beginning to happen even when I was at GIDS in 2004, there is activism within the NHS, and unfortunately it silences debate. And Cass highlighted this in her review. The problem is those children were not followed up then. They were then prevented by the adult clinics in the NHS from being allowed to see what has happened to those children. And somehow that's all filtered away. I believe the Tavistock got about £1 million to do that research work. Nobody asks for this to be followed up on. There are hundreds of children, as I say, who have already experienced having their puberty blocked. And the important thing to say about this study, it's only 2 years. That is like a drop in the ocean of someone's life, and it won't give us any meaningful information. Even if the children say, that, yes, I feel better. Of course, if they're struggling with their adolescence and everything that that's throwing at them, and their identity is feeling fragile and their distress feels unbearable, they will believe that the drugs will help them feel better. And they might well do. But what you do is you interfere with the task of development. You interfere with the child learning that psychologically they might come to like themselves. They might be able to accept themselves.
Forgive me, we're out of time now, I'm afraid. But I think you made your case very, very clearly there. Susan Evans arguing that these trials are wrong, and despite the fact that they are regulated by government agencies and recommended by CAS, she thinks it is a mistake to proceed with them. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
It is 17 minutes to nine as Ukraine's future is debated and discussed once again in the form of what a ceasefire deal with Russia may or may not do to the country's sovereignty and to its borders. It makes us look backwards because, located as it is between the West and Russia, it's always been in a geographically tricky position. Professor Timothy Garton-Ash is the author of Homelands, A Personal History of Europe, and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
We spend so much time looking forwards when it comes to this particular story, but actually looking backwards can be instructive, even though we don't do it very often, because it highlights really and gives essential context as to why Ukraine is struggling in many ways to preserve its sovereignty now.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I just pulled off the shelf a 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, where Ukraine gets just five lines and is defined as, I quote, the name formerly given to a district of European Russia. You know, that's how Imperial Britain saw Ukraine 120 years ago. And what happens at the end of the First World War is that most of those big land empires, Russian, German, Austro-Hungarian, Ottoman, disintegrate or pulled apart by the victorious powers, and a whole raft of nations get their own states, including, by the way, Kaya Kallas's country, Estonia. But Ukraine doesn't. Ukraine remains the largest nation in Europe without a state. And it's only since the end of the Cold War, since 1991, that Ukraine has finally got its own state and is, of course, struggling to defend its sovereignty and independence from a Russia which basically doesn't recognize it as an independent country. I mean, Vladimir Putin has said that explicitly.
And we go back, I suppose, as well, don't we, to a time where empires changed and shifted because land was taken by force, which isn't something that we do anymore, certainly not something we recognise under international law.
Indeed. I mean, I think what is so amazing and shocking about this 28-point plan, I know it's, you know, like much the Trump administration does here today, gone tomorrow, but it's an interesting document because what you have is not just Russia, but also the United States under Donald Trump, essentially going back to a world of empires and spheres of influence. We, the US and Russia, will tell another country, Ukraine, where its frontiers will be, how much territory it must give up, how small its army is going to be, which alliances it's allowed to join, even when it's going to have elections. That's a very familiar old world. I mean, that's how Europe behaved 120 years ago. You know, it's in a way it's the ghost of our own bad past. And the challenge for Europe now is, do we stand up for the different way of doing things that we have embraced, mainly with the United States also since 1945, namely not a world of empires and spheres of influence, but a world of independent countries where frontiers can only be changed by peaceful means.
What do you think Ukraine's future is? Whose sphere of influence is it likely to fall under, do you think?
Well, I hope it nobody's sphere of influence in the sense in which we've been talking about it, i.e. an empire tells you what you can and can't do. But clearly, Ukraine, the whole of Ukraine now wants to be with Europe. And its future depends not, I think, on anything that's written on any piece of paper. I mean, Donald Trump may land at some airport and say, you know, this piece of paper which bears Mr. Putin's signature and mine, but it won't be worth the paper it's written on. It depends on how much sustained military, economic and political support Europe in particular, but also some other countries, will give to Ukraine so that it becomes a viable country able actually to defend itself against Russia and deter any likely future Russian attack.
Professor Timothy Garton-Ash, really fascinating to hear from you. Thank you. The author of Homelands, A Personal History of Europe.
13 minutes to nine. I've never directly racially abused anybody, Nigel Farage said last night in response to an investigation by The Guardian, which revealed that 20 people who were at school with him alleged he'd made racist or anti-Semitic remarks to them. The leader of Reform UK was being questioned by the BBC's Welsh political editor, Gareth Lewis.
At school, categorically on the record, you did not racially abuse fellow pupils.
I would never, ever do it in a hurtful or insulting way.
That's not quite the same as not doing it.
It's 49 years ago. It's 49 years ago.
What difference is it? What difference is the time?
Isn't it? Well, you know, I just entered my teens. Can I remember everything that happened at school? No, I can't.
The claims built on Michael Crick's biography of Farage, published 3 years ago, which revealed that teachers at Dulwich College had warned against making him a prefect because of what they described then, back in 1981, as his publicly professed racist and neo-fascist views. Mr. Farage has always insisted that he was a target of people because he admitted, well, not admitted, he was proud to say that he was a supporter of Enoch Powell's. Michael Crick, the journalist, former political editor of Newsnight and Channel 4 News, author of One Party After Another, The Disruptive Life of Nigel Farage, joins us now. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, clearly, The Guardian have been building on a lot of work you've done over a lot of time. Are you reading and hearing things that surprise you, that add to? Are they merely adding colour to the story we already had?
No, they're adding colour, and some people who didn't want to be named before now are willing to be named. But it's still the basic story. It dates back, actually, to 2013 when I first came across this letter that you've just mentioned from a teacher complaining that Farage had been made a prefect. And but largely the story's been ignored by other people up until now. It's now getting a lot of coverage. I mean, essentially, he was horribly anti-Semitic at Dulwich, in my view. Sometimes he wasn't very nice to some of the Asian boys. But I don't believe he's an anti-Semite now. But I do think it's interesting the way in which his response to all this has been sort of swerving one way and the other. I mean, in the past, in response to what I did on Channel 4 News and what I did for my book, he sort of dismissed it lightheartedly. And, you know, he sort of said, oh, well, you know, when we were 15, everybody got it. And it was particularly bad for the red-haired boys. Whereas now he's taking a rather different line. And then at one point, a few weeks ago, his barrister was threatening to sue The Guardian for malicious publication and threatened to claim aggravated damages. I think Farage really ought to come out and say, look, if I did say offensive things like that, if I offended people, particularly Jewish people, in a really horrible way, I am deeply sorry. That was me when I was 14, 15, 16 or whatever. And I deeply regret that. And I am not that man now. That's what he ought to say.
Yeah, well, let's focus on what he did say for a second. That phrase that he repeated again and again, I never directly was the emphasis, racially abused anybody. And then he refers to banter and misspeaking, doesn't he? He appears to be saying, look, I may have said, pick your word, some unsavoury, some unpleasant things. Well, but what I didn't say is you, Michael, or you, Bob, or whoever, I am now insulting because of your ethnicity, or indeed because you're Jewish.
But to go up to a boy and say, you lot should be gassed, and Hitler was right, and then to make a hissing sound, that is one of the most appalling things one can imagine. Now, admittedly, that was by a teenage boy, not an adult. And obviously he wouldn't say that now. But
and he does deny that, doesn't he, Michael? Just on that specific, because it's important. Yeah. He does deny that.
He does. And he also says he can't remember what happened 40 years ago. Well, I think the memory of the poor boy that heard that is very credible. And it's the sort of thing that if you were Jewish, you would remember for the rest of your life. Absolutely appalling thing to say. And also the regular singing of a horrible song, Gas 'em All, Gas 'em All, to the tune of Bless 'em All, on the school CCF trips and so on. I mean, the words are the following words are so horrid I wouldn't want to repeat them. Again, that is pretty vile stuff.
Michael, let's just remind people, I'm going to keep saying it because it is important to say that he consistently denies racially abusing people. When your biography came out, people were waiting to see whether you would say Nigel Farage was a racist, because they knew of the work that you'd done to dig this up. And you did not conclude that, as I recall, and in large part because you found no pattern of behaviour towards people or in ethnic minorities later in life that would allow you to make that claim. Do you still say, actually, later in life, whatever happened in earlier times, which is disputed, however awful it sounds, you do not believe there's a pattern of behaviour later to suggest he's a racist?
That's broadly the position, yes. In researching my book, everybody I spoke to, or nearly everybody, I would ask them, you've known him, do you ever recall him saying anything racist? And indeed, a lot of these people were huge critics of Farage, people who'd fallen out with him within UKIP, broadly agreed with his politics, but had fallen out with him, disliked him. And you know, there was the opportunity for them to say, yes, he's a terrible racist, but they weren't willing to say that. They would say horrible things about him in other regards, but they weren't saying it. And I came to the conclusion that in his adult life, he was not, certainly not overtly racist. There was only one instance remembered by Alan Sked, the founder and leader of UKIP, a case, again, a horrible remark that I wouldn't want to repeat on the radio, but nobody can corroborate that, and I've never found another example of that, and that was from 30 years ago. So okay. My verdict is that overtly, he's not racist. I think at times he panders to racism, you know, there are occasions when you think he's just, you know, on the line. But I think overall, I don't think you can say he is a racist. No.
Michael Crick, we've got to leave it there, but thank you for that. The book is called One Party After Another.
6:56 now. A new landmark biography of Henry VIII's painter Hans Holbein is revealing new stories about some of his most famous creations. And you may well know the name or you may not, but you will certainly recognise the paintings, because most of what we know about his royal court and what he and his wives and his friends and his enemies looked like is all drawn from them. Well, Dr. Elizabeth Goldring joins us in the studio, the author of Holbein, Renaissance Master, and Professor Tracy Borman is on the line, Tudor historian, broadcaster, and joint chief curator at the Historic Royal Palaces. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Goldring, I mean, some of these works are extraordinary, particularly later works are almost photographic in their levels of detail.
Absolutely.
But so well known, but you still managed to find out new things about them.
That was the really exciting and really fun thing about writing this book. People often said to me when I was working on it, how can there possibly be anything new to say about Holbein? And I was delighted and quite relieved, I have to admit, that there was always something new to find about every phase of his life and career. And I mean, I suppose that's the mark of a great artist, that there is always more to say. But really incredibly exciting. I was able to show, from looking at inventories and other documents that tell us what the English had hanging on their walls in the 16th century, that it is really when Holbein arrives in England in the mid-1520s that the English catch the portraiture bug. This is when they start commissioning portraits of themselves, exchanging portraits, the vogue for collecting and displaying images of the great and the good and filling your long gallery with such portraits all takes off thanks to Holbein, in concert with early patrons like Thomas More and Thomas Cromwell.
Yeah, and what we learn from that and their lasting impact, Professor Borman, is that what everything that we infuse these historical characters with now, people we never met, we don't know a great deal about, so much of it is drawn from the way that the painter chooses to represent them.
It really is. And actually what Holbein did was to sort of hold up a mirror to the Tudor court. And I'm often asked, you know, why are we still talking about the Tudors? Why are they so popular? Actually, I credit Holbein with a lot of that, because suddenly we get these startlingly detailed and realistic portraits. And it feels like you could just reach out and touch these people. His skill was quite remarkable. And it's wonderful that we're still celebrating him today. But he was also an image maker, you know, one of the most influential members of the Tudor court. He showed Henry VIII as this all-powerful, kind of invincible monarch, well beyond the time that Henry was anything like that, when he was, you know, virtually, you know, crippled from his jousting accident and, you know, sort of bloated tyrant. Yet he remains this image of magisterial power, thanks to Holbein.
Yeah, it almost, you can see the parallels, Elizabeth, in modern times, the way that people, you know, the selfie, the way that people collect pictures of themselves.
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. There's something very modern, I think, about Holbein, but possibly an important distinction between Holbein's portraits, so the selfies we are all taking and posting on Instagram, is that we're still talking about Holbein's images 500 years after he first set foot in England. And thanks to Holbein, Henry VIII and his leading courtiers and his queens and would-be queens are some of the most immediately recognisable figures in all of history. And I don't know how many of the selfies we are taking today will...
Presumably the quality of the work helps with that. If they were bad pictures,
absolutely,
they would probably have got lost.
Absolutely. Although having said that, what survives is probably just the tip of the iceberg. Another interesting discovery I made is that all of Henry's leading courtiers were commissioning multiple images of themselves from Holbein. So the famous portraits of More and Cromwell and the Frick that we all know, we have seared on our brains. It's clear that More and Cromwell ordered multiple copies, multiple versions, but no doubt when each fell from favour, a lot of people decided to throw those paintings on the fire because it wouldn't have been politically shrewd to continue to display those.
Yeah, and I feel in our last minute or so, Tracy, we can't not mention Anne of Cleves, particularly because her story, you know, it's been reimagined on the stage now in the musical Six, and that whole marriage, well, so the story goes, was based on the portrait, which turned out not to quite offer apparently what it suggested.
Absolutely, my favourite of the six, I have to say, Anne of Cleves. And it's a real myth that Holbein stitched Henry up by flattering Anne in this portrait. Yes, it was a very alluring portrait, but the real problem with this marriage for Henry is that Anne just wasn't the sort of woman he wanted to marry. She didn't have the sort of courtier characteristics that he was used to in a wife. And so their first meeting was disastrous, but a lot of blame.
Oh, I think we've lost Tracy. Right? Oh, there we go. We lost you right at the last there, Tracy. But we got the main points of what you were saying. Our deputy editor's very helpfully provided me with the quote, the word for word quote from Six. You said that I tricked you because I didn't look like my profile picture.